Okay. Welcome, everyone. Today is May 24th, 2016. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. I am sorry that we're short a few people. A few people are going to be coming in late. My good vice chair here has to leave at 3:30. The other good vice chair is actually in Washington, D.C. at the White House on a committee work group on domestic violence. And so we've got several other people here. I believe that Representative Bueller is going to be calling in or listening. So while you may not see a full dais here, I know that people are trying to fit it in as they can, and I will make sure that the information that you've been so good to take your time to come and present gets to them, even if they're not hearing it directly right now. So thank you all for being here. I want to open an informational meeting on Oregon Department of Housing and Community Services and the Medicare waiver, and can we start with Margaret Van Vliet? And while she's coming up here, I want to thank our temporary committee administrator, Cheyenne Ross, who is the committee administrator for the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. It's great to have you. Our regular committee administrator, Adam Crawford, is over with one of the other committees that he is in, marijuana or something. He's with another committee right now, so another joint committee. Ms. Van Vliet.
Chair Kenny-Guyer and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet, and for a few more days, I am the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about the state of the agency I've had the privilege to lead for the past 4.5 years. As I shared with Governor Brown, I am proud to leave behind an agency which is well-positioned to help address the housing crisis facing our state. Every program OHCS runs is delivering stronger results and helping more Oregonians than just a few years ago. From programs that assist those experiencing homelessness or housing instability, to delivering affordable rental housing, to helping families access and retain homeownership, we have strengthened outcomes as well as transparency, accountability, and community partnerships. We've integrated our work with other state agencies, transformed our policy and governance system, and achieved financial sustainability. LIFT and mental health housing investments are on the verge of being launched, and our strong performance has helped us bring new federal dollars to Oregon. Perhaps most importantly, our employees and managers are mission-driven, committed to excellence, and resilient. They remain committed to carrying out the overall agency redesign we charted out almost 3 years ago. With the progress we've made at OHCS, we are now ready to generate a statewide housing plan. Our agency is rationing scarce resources every day, and we need to articulate priorities and target investments through a robust, data-driven planning process. We need clarity about what we will and will not be able to do with our limited dollars. Everyone at OHCS and on our Housing Stability Council is very excited about what's possible in this regard, and I know that they will be eager to work closely with this committee going forward. Now, in spite of my overall optimism, I want to stress that our core strengths and improved performance has not been easily won, and I see both opportunities and threats on the horizon. In that spirit, I want to offer a few observations from my perch for your consideration. First, the housing crisis didn't happen overnight. It's been brewing for probably 30 years and has its roots in big structural issues like our tax system, policy changes at the federal level, in migration to Oregon, and our evolving economy. I know that you've been studying these forces since this committee was explicitly charged with working on housing, but before that time, housing really wasn't on the radar screen in this building. And it's tempting to, in this time of overwhelming housing cost burdens, foreclosures, and homelessness, to assign blame to greedy developers or landlords, big bad banks, Oregon's land use system, or the federal government. But I think you know by now that there is no one source of the problem and certainly no quick fix. And assigning blame isn't actually all that helpful. Housing is fundamentally a matter our society has consigned to the private sector, and government at all levels really only tinkers on the margins of that sector. Indeed, the agency that I run is but a small player in the overall housing system, and now, no matter how you slice it, our crisis comes down to inadequate supply, not enough units of housing for all the people who live here. I've come to believe that production of homes at any income level will be helpful because increasing the supply of a good inevitably impacts its price in the overall marketplace. I'm in favor of high-end housing and affordable housing built everywhere. I'm also in favor of things like upzoning in high-end neighborhoods and communities, tiny houses, shipping container housing, micro-apartments, 1,000-square-foot starter homes, accessory dwelling units, and manufactured or modular homes. I personally think we need to be open to taller buildings in more places, and yes, increasing density, even if it means our favorite food cart pod or ad hoc and unplanned open space has to go. Government needs to continue providing smart and cost-effective incentives, and some of those may need to evolve and become more targeted, with an eye on long-term implications and a willingness to change course if necessary. Money is only part of the solution, and rethinking where some public money goes currently ought to be on the table. Number two, the urban-rural divide could get worse before it gets better. As you probably know, voters in Multnomah County are going to consider a ballot measure in November that would raise new revenue through a tax levy for affordable housing. Now, I am very much in favor of new revenue to boost the public sector role in creating affordable housing. At the same time, I worry that if metro area leaders take care of their own needs, they could be less inclined to participate in statewide solutions. Number three, the change agenda for the affordable housing system needs to continue. I have spent a considerable part of my tenure asking everyone around me to question their assumptions about how business should be conducted. Whether it's opening up the part of the Oregon Revised Statutes that address who in Oregon is in the lead for carrying out the anti-poverty agenda, sunsetting long-standing advisory bodies, questioning the very existence of my agency, or challenging how much public subsidy should be allocated for what kinds of work, it has been my privilege to convene stakeholders and business partners to debate some really hard questions. I've learned a lot, and much of that intelligence has worked its way into the design of our program and our administrative rules. But I don't think we're done. There is still a very real housing crisis in every corner of the state, and all of us who care about housing stability owe it to our state to keep digging deep and sacrificing some of what we have come to rely on to try and get more people into housing. I can tell you that OHCS, as an organization, knows it needs to keep evolving. I hope its partners are as willing to evolve, and I hope this committee continues to hold everyone accountable. Number four, the infrastructure of OHCS is stronger than it was, but it remains fragile. OHCS can't take on additional tasks without more skilled workers to do them. There is more we could do to integrate our data systems, provide more regular housing market research and analytics, deepen our cross-agency alignment, track private market activity like evictions, rent increases, condo conversions, building permits, and the like, speed up customer responsiveness, and invest in innovation. But there is no source of funds for that kind of work inside of OHCS. As many of you know, there's history here about our financial and business model and how that has changed in the last several years. Suffice to say, the legislature will face the question about investing in the agency infrastructure, separate and apart from investments in housing production and homelessness services. The best example of this I can give you is that you're going to hear next from one of two housing integrators who work for OHCS. And I predict you're going to be very encouraged by what he and Director Lori Coyner, share with you about the collaboration between our agency and the Oregon Health Authority. Kenny is very talented, and he is spread pretty thin. We fund his position internally, which works in our financial model, but it's not replicable or scalable beyond what Kenny and his one equally talented colleague are able to do for us, unless there's an investment to make that happen. Madam Chair, those are my nuggets of wisdom, if you will, for today. When I leave next week, Claire Seguin will assume the role of interim director for OHCS. Claire is a skilled and articulate leader, and I have great confidence in her ability to steer the ship for whatever duration Governor Brown deems appropriate. In closing, I want to thank you again for the opportunity to work with you. I wish all of you the very best as you continue pressing for solutions to the critical issues around housing access and stability. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comments. You hit on all the points that I was hoping you would hit, kind of a big look back over the 4 years. And I want to personally thank you for how accessible you've been, how you have steered the ship amazingly well over a four-year period and gotten it to the place where it is during some very turbulent times. You put a lot of ideas on the table, probably more freely than I've heard you be able to say before, and I want to thank you for your service. And also, after a much deserved break, I hope that you continue to stay very engaged in these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I have one question. Just you mentioned that you were able to access some more federal dollars, and can you tell us a little, since resources is one, I know we're going to hear about land use and zoning policies and other kind of things in a subsequent panel, and in the one right after this, we're going to hear about the waiver that may bring more housing dollars to the table. But can you tell us, when you were saying you've brought some more federal dollars, what are those? What has the increase been? And what does the projection look like, separate from the waiver?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the biggest source of federal dollars is the additional hardest hit fund money. Our original allocation back in 2010 was $220 million. This is money from U.S. Treasury that originated as actually TARP money, you'll recall. That's for foreclosure avoidance. We were just awarded $94.5 million additional dollars in that program, and part of that is very much attributable to our success in getting our original allocation fully expended in very much in keeping with the mission of those dollars and ahead of all the other states. So I think that's the biggest piece. The other piece we've done is we've brought in there's the Medicaid stuff, which you'll hear about. We received a grant from HUD called the 811 program. It's just a couple of million dollars, but it provides housing assistance in the form of rental assistance for people with disabilities, and we're partnering with DHS and OHA on that as well. So those are the biggies.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you
so much. Claire is not in the audience.
Claire is in the audience.
She is? Okay, good. It's nice to put a face to a name. We look forward to working with you, too. Okay, thank you. Can we please now have Kenny LaPointe from Housing Community Services and Lori Koiner from OHA, Medicaid Director.
Can I?
And is Amanda also in here somewhere? Would you like to come join them at the same time?
Can I pipe in?
Yes, pipe in. Pipe in.
So, Margaret, I just had this assumption that despite you changing or moving to a different season of life, that you would be returning and we'll continue seeing you, you know, in this building. So I didn't sit here and say thank you for all your hard work. I've, you know, enjoyed getting to know you over the last year and a half, but I'm assuming this is not goodbye, that it's a see you later, have a good vacation, we'll see you in February. So anyway, so that's why it
she's like,
didn't
no!
trigger. Good luck with that.
I have her cell number, so unless she changes it. So thank you all for coming, and I know, Kenny, you have to drive to Klamath Falls, so we want to be aware of that. And I was thinking it might be great, Amanda, to start with you, because you lay out the case for why housing stability is so important and can lower the healthcare costs, and which is why I think you're going in the direction that you are, working together. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Great.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Amanda Saul. I work for Enterprise Community Partners, and I'm the Senior Program Director for the Pacific Northwest Office. Thank you for having me here today. I just made it in the nick of time. There was an accident on I-5, so thank you. Enterprise is a national nonprofit, and we support affordable housing and community facilities by investing in them and providing grants to the nonprofits that build and own them. And we provide policy advocacy at the federal and state levels. And we also develop programs that are specific to each market. And about 3 years ago in Oregon, we started a learning collaborative that brought together nine affordable housing housing organizations and a multitude of people from the healthcare system, and really started to look at ways that we could partner better, that we could learn each other's languages better, and pilot some very specific programs that did a better job of linking health and housing, specifically at the affordable housing projects. And part of the work that we also did was we partnered with Providence's Center for Outcomes Research and Education on a study that, and I brought copies, that looked at the cost savings and utilization on Medicaid of people living in affordable housing. And I'm going to really briefly go over the findings of the study. But I'll just say that what's a little bit different about this study, there's been a number of studies that have been done by organizations like CSH, Corporation for Supportive Housing, that have looked at the effects of Medicaid costs on permanent supportive housing. This particular study was a little bit broader. It looked at 145 affordable housing projects in the Portland metro region, and looked at housing projects that served low-income families, projects that were permanent supportive housing, so projects for single adults who are often experiencing chronic homelessness, and then also projects that are set aside for people that are seniors and people with disabilities. And the question that we were trying to address is, what's the effect of stable, affordable housing on Medicaid costs, how people utilize health care, and what specific role do integrated health services have on those costs? And so there were four major findings. Actually, I'm going to take a step back really quick before I go into the findings. I think one of the things that I found really striking, I come from an affordable housing background, and one of the things that I found really striking from the study is the level of acuity of the people living in our affordable housing projects. I think people in our affordable housing projects are 2 to 3 times sicker than the average Medicaid member living in that same geographic region. And so for me, that really made the case of why it was even more important that we do a better job linking health to the people living in our affordable housing, and that we try to align the buckets of money that are serving those people better. So I'll quickly go over the four findings. Overall, across the board of those three target populations, families, seniors, and people living in permanent supportive housing, there was a 12% Medicaid cost savings just by moving into affordable housing. That's an average of $48 per member per month. And depending on those three housing types, it was higher for people living in the housing for seniors and people with disabilities, and also higher for people living in the units, permanent supportive housing units. I think what was even more exciting than the cost savings is that people started to use healthcare in the right way. Once people moved into affordable housing, their usage of primary care visits went up by 20%, and their usage of emergency department room visits went down by 18%. So not only is there a cost savings, but people are getting the right kind of preventative care. And this was not, at the expense of how people self-reported their quality and access to care. So even though costs were going down, people self-reported that they still had good access and good quality of care. So that was another good thing. Lastly, we were able to identify that affordable housing, when coupled with health-related services, actually increased the savings from $48 per member per month to about $115 per member per month, which is striking. So more than double the cost savings when you intentionally couple health-related services and affordable housing. And so we're really happy to see the draft 1115 Medicaid waiver that OHA has published, because I think they're doing a really great job of bringing together those health-related services and affordable housing. We support the use of Medicaid funds for rental assistance and support the use of Medicaid funds for services that are happening in affordable housing and the coordination of those services. I think I'll stop there.
And I want to make sure that anyone listening in knows that you can see this report under the materials section of our agenda.
Oh, great.
Yes,
thank you.
It's on there. And I think what's interesting is that I had thought that your report would be, until hearing it and looking at the report, that it would be if you provide stable housing, that automatically translates into health savings, which clearly it does. But you've also emphasize that the opposite is also true, and further leverages it, that if you are going to provide affordable housing and we are putting an investment, that that's leveraged furthermore by making sure that they have good access to health care. And
right.
I hadn't, when I thought you were going to present, I was only thinking about the first part and not the second, how those two things complement. And we have been doing a lot of work with the task group on housing with services, so it's got a lot of implications for the things that we're working on. Do you have any questions?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Chair Kenny Geyer. So you said your organization's national. Is there places in the United States that you're familiar with where the crisis is less, and if it's less, why are they able to manage it so much better than we are here?
The housing crisis?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you for your question. I would say that part of our challenge, the housing crisis in Oregon, I think, is it's come about over time. It's a huge increase in rental rates and the cost of homeownership and how quickly that's risen, and the fact that our affordable housing resources have not been able to keep pace with that. And so I think that in other places like Seattle, Washington, although they are also having a housing crisis, they have more affordable housing resources, and so it helps to maybe tame down the crisis slightly.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Medicaid waiver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kenny LaPointe. Excuse me. And I am a housing integrator for Oregon Housing and Community Services. I had the privilege of being offered this position by Director Van Vliet about a year and a half ago, not knowing she would be leaving us. But I took this position. I actually came from Central Oregon, where I worked for a housing authority for a number of years and a community action agency before that. Honestly, I've been in the housing business for quite some time, and a few years back, one of my children was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and it gave me the opportunity to really reflect on the work that I do and the clients that I'm serving and how health conditions can impact their lives and housing stability can impact their health. And that really got me engaged in this healthcare world. And got me doing some work with my CCO, my coordinated care organization in Central Oregon. So Director Van Vliet had hired me to be a housing integrator, which means that I work across the state with regional collaboratives like coordinated care organizations, early learning hubs, workforce investment boards, regional solutions teams, to really connect the dots with these other sectors between their sector and the housing sector, really identifying how we can use our state housing dollars to stabilize individuals and families in these other systems to help those systems achieve their outcomes, which also helps us achieve our outcomes. Housing stability helps us achieve the triple aim of better health, better care, and lower costs. Housing stability helps us achieve the Early Learning Hub's goals of stable and attached families. I think these are critical priorities, and we want to integrate our housing resources into those worlds. Part of my position has been really bringing communities together to have these conversations, and Representative Stark has been involved in those as well. And really, this is a different world that we're getting into, and having these cross-sector conversations has been rather interesting, because I feel like we're coming into the room with different languages that we speak. And so we're really trying to figure out where we meet in the middle. And so a lot of that has been education on what we do and how we do it, in order for us to find out where we can meet in the middle. This 1115 Medicaid waiver renewal is, I think, a critical move in the right direction. And I very much appreciate our partner agency, the Oregon Health Authority, with Lori's direction and the work that they've done on this waiver. I think it's been very important. They've done some great outreach to communities to find out what are the real barriers to doing this work further. And I think the waiver identifies those barriers and breaks them down. And that's a very critical role that we're playing here. I think when you talk about operationalizing this work, some things that we're seeing across the state right now, coordinated care organizations have invested in housing-related supports and services. The waiver change would actually make this more sustainable in the long run. I think that's important to note. Coordinated care organizations are using their savings dollars and transformation dollars to do this work now. We've seen community health workers that have been hired and placed within an affordable housing agency and are working within that agency's portfolio to identify clients that are living in those affordable housing units and what healthcare services they need, and then connecting them to those services.
I'll be on Facebook later.
Right. Another thing that we've also seen, which Amanda also touched on, was co-located housing and services. Before I left Central Oregon to come over to work for the state, we actually opened a federally qualified health clinic in a 166-unit apartment complex in Bend. And I can tell you that that service on site for those residents has played a critical role in their health improvement. This type of integrated work has also played a significant role in ending chronic homelessness. The state of Oregon, back in December, was selected to participate in what's called the Innovation Accelerator Program. We were one of eight states selected to participate in this technical assistance collaborative between the Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Human Services, and Oregon Housing and Community Services. There were 32 applicant states, and we were one of eight that were selected. I think a lot of that lends to the work that we're doing to progressively move this agenda forward. The idea behind the Innovation Accelerator Program is that we're going to be doing work on the state level to better set in place our partnerships and also strategically identify areas of the state where this can really move. We'll be developing a statewide action plan that's going to align resources across agencies and also provide a critical training role that will be coordinated across the three agencies that are participating. I think the last thing that I sort of want to end with is that I believe that the integration of housing and healthcare is going to play a critical role in reducing healthcare costs. It's also going to play a critical role in stabilizing the health of families and individuals, which I believe is the most important aspect of that. Housing, stable and affordable, can be a very, very powerful prescription. Thank you.
Thank you. Hold off about the waiver until we've heard both. Okay, Lori.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Koiner. I'm the State Medicaid Director with the Oregon Health Authority. And first off, I want to thank Chair Kenny Geyer for inviting me to come and present. It's an honor to be able to describe some of the work that we've been doing with Kenny and Amanda, and it's really been the groundwork to get us to where we are with the waiver. So I'm going to start a little bit to give you a high-level overview about what the waiver is and what it's not, why housing now, and then kind of where we are and where we plan to go. So for those of you not steeped in healthcare policy, there are two main ways that we implement initiatives through with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services for Medicaid. One is what's called the state plan. That is describes how we implement services for our Medicaid clients. And then there's something called an 1115 demonstration waiver, which is an opportunity to color outside the lines, provide maybe what wouldn't normally be covered under a state plan, and it's our job to convince the CMS that what we're going to do is going to improve the health of our Medicaid clients, as well as not cost the federal government any more money. So and so we refer that is that it must be budget neutral. So Oregon has had a 1115 demonstration waiver in place since 1994, but many of you probably heard about the waiver that we had renewed in 2012, and that was the beginning of our coordinated care model, and it's really the opportunity that stood up the 16 coordinated care organizations. They've focused on integrating behavioral, physical, and oral health services. It's been very successful. We've had national recognition, and I was back in D.C. last week, and CMS said they really support the model. They point to it as a model system, and so we are now in the process of the renewal for another 5 years. So as we're thinking about the renewal, we've been having conversations with Kenny and others around housing. We also have been having conversations with the CCOs, and many are engaged in housing services, as Kenny described, but that we found that across the 16 CCOs, there's wide variation in terms of what they're doing, how much penetration there is in terms of working with their housing community. And given the background information that Director Van Vliet just went through, it was apparent that housing is a crisis in Oregon. So what we've proposed, and in thinking about the next 5 years, we want to stick with the model we have. We spent a lot of time talking about, well, what lessons have we learned? Where can we improve? And the CCOs made lots of progress. But in the areas of improving social determinants of health, we realized that that's been harder than envisioned. It takes longer than just 4 years. We're 4 years in. We see that it's going to take another six. So we're asking for federal financial participation to support pilot programs. Each of the coordinated care organizations would be eligible to become a pilot. In addition, in discussions with tribal governments, we will also be investigating a tribal coordinated health partnerships also. We're calling them coordinated health partnerships, and as part of these pilots, the CCOs will be required to engage in local housing agencies, counties, hospitals, corrections to work in three areas. One is what we call homelessness prevention. It's really targeted towards more seamless and coordinated care transitions. So when we think about someone who is leaving the state hospital or leaving and we're asking that they begin their coordinated care organization coverage 30 days before discharge so that they can start to understand what medications they need, who their doctor is, where they're going to live, and those kinds of services. So we have programs around that. The second domain of the partnerships is on housing tenancy, and so that would be helping these high-risk individuals, many much like those that were in the study that Amanda described, help them find housing, pay first and last month rent. There's a number of supports and services that Medicaid dollars can be used for to support tenancy services. And then the final is housing sustaining services. So providing supports and services around how to get health care, how to not be evicted, and stay in a stable housing situation. And so we also are spending more time talking about what we call health-related services. So these are services that the CCOs can spend dollars on to support their members, but wouldn't normally send a billing claim for. So an example would be if there's a child with who has asthma and their home has mold, that a CCO can pay for mold abatement. They can't bill necessarily a medical claim for that. So we call those flexible services. There were some challenges for CCOs to be able to make those kinds of investments. We've made some proposals to CMS on how we can improve those challenges or solve those problems. And then together, we think that by allowing CCOs to invest in flexible services and have these pilots with additional federal dollars that would help with building infrastructure for all of these agencies who haven't typically worked together, that we can move both housing sustaining services, sustainable housing, healthcare, all forward in the next 5 years. So thank you.
That's very exciting. So we had a presentation in the healthcare committee this morning about the waiver, and I think one of the points I want to make also is that they're open for public comment through June 1st, and in the materials section under Lloyd Corner presentation, you will see the link there if you want to see the waiver draft, and if there's a way that you can give input. And for any of the people out there in this human services and housing, I hope that if you haven't already commented that you would give any additional thoughts, support to their case to CMS back in Washington, D.C., because I think it's a really important. I call it the Transformation 2.0. So we did the 1.0 5 years ago. You will be presenting, you're submitting this, I think, in late June and hoping to hear in the fall.
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thanks for bringing this up. We do have a draft waiver on the Oregon.gov website. It's open for public comment. We welcome public comment and feedback through June 1st. There's also some summary documents if you don't want to read the full entire, 70 plus pages, and as well as an executive summary. We respond to all the public comment and collate that together and refine the final document. It will be submitted to CMS mid-June. Our current waiver expires in June of 2017, and we are working with CMS right now to try to obtain approval before the administration change by the end of the year.
So one of the things that I'm very excited by is that we often are in silos, and I think that you've done great interagency collaboration, and I think of housing and community services as really being able to do the bricks and mortar and not the services, and then housing authority does services operations but can't do bricks and mortar. The example that you gave of cleaning up mold, we're not just treating asthma. You're talking about actually cleaning up the mold. That actually is somewhere in the middle. So you're trying to find that intersection that maybe each of you thought somebody else was responsible for. So I applaud you in that. I've heard a couple things. People are wondering, why are seniors and people with disabilities perhaps not called out in the waiver? I've not read the whole waiver. I don't know if there's if that's true, is there an opportunity to focus on housing for people with seniors and disabilities? The other thing I'll say is hunger is another area that I know people have a great interest in. As we're looking at social determinants of health, the way that I'm going to relate it to this housing conversation is that as much as we can do housing and make sure that if it's for people with seniors and disabilities, that it's near transportation and that it's near sources of, we talk about food deserts or food farm stands. How can we make sure that when we're investing in housing for people with seniors and disabilities, that they have access to those things? For children, I would say near childcare or having childcare on the premises. I love the idea of the 166 units with the healthcare there, but there's been a lot of work in developing affordable housing that has childcare so that people can bring their children there, and it's also an employment opportunity. So I'm wondering how much of those kind of social determinants of health you're looking at in the waiver, you're trying to promote or get permission to do in your pilot projects.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, those are all great questions. We include dual eligibles, so we do include members who both qualify for Medicare and Medicaid, and so many of those are seniors with disabilities. Mm-hmm. For additional disabilities, we actually have within DHS what are called 1915 waivers that offer a number of housing supports and services for people with developmental disabilities and others. This is a Medicaid waiver, so we aren't asking or aren't involved in Medicare, so the seniors that we're limited to in this waiver are those who are dual eligible. In terms of other aspects of social determinants of health, that was partly why we wanted to solve the problem of CCOs investing in what we are calling health-related services to make that easier. Also, the metrics and scoring committee that establishes the incentive metrics for CCOs has been working with the Oregon Primary Care Association on a food scarcity measure. It's not ready, but there is work that's been going on both with our technical advisory group around how to operationalize that and looking at that towards the future. So there is work, but it's not necessarily spelled out in our waiver, and that's partly because we don't always have to have waiver authority to move some of these programs forward.
Thank you. Questions? Representative
Gallegos. Yes, thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I appreciate that the chair raised the issue of siloing and brought up, you know, food scarcity and all kinds of other things that we need to be concerned about. But I just wanted to point out that it's important also to recognize that school success is really highly dependent upon the connection between healthcare and housing. And we're never, never, ever going to get to 40-40-20 unless we can sort of bring all of these pieces together. So thank you for your work.
I will build on that great comment. Representative Gallegos, are you having this kind of collaboration with the Oregon Department of Education in submitting this waiver? Or the Early Learning Council?
Chair Kenny Geyer, we have not engaged the Department of Education for the waiver. We have a piece where we're working with public health and increasing nurse home visits for families at risk and expanding that program so that it will include nurse home visits for in the prenatal time period as well as following kids through age 5. But and that's really the major piece on you know early learning that we've incorporated into the waiver.
Okay.
I can. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I forgot to mention that the 166-unit apartment complex has a Boys and Girls Club on site as well. And we are convening folks from the early learning hubs in each region to bring them into this conversation because, like I said, just as we want to use our housing dollars to stabilize families and individuals in the healthcare system, we want to do the same for families who have children that are entering the school system. So if we can stabilize them at an early age and make sure that they have adequate resources to be successful in school, we definitely want to see that happening. At our last Housing Stability Council meeting, we had a Central Oregon Early Learning Hub director come and present to our Housing Stability Council to talk about the importance of housing to their families. So we definitely recognize that that's critical, and we are encouraging that work.
That's great. And public comment is open for one more week. So, any other questions, comments? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your
Thank
presentation.
You.
Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Oregon Housing and Community Services and the Medicaid waiver. An open informational hearing on housing cost drivers. And we will start with Josh Lehner, saying the name right. Thank you. And Mike Wilkerson. We'll start with our two economists taking a statewide look. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee for having us up here to talk about some of the underlying cost drivers in the housing market today. As Director Van Vliet started off with, this certainly is an affordability issue. Today, I'm going to talk mostly about some of the demand drivers, what's going on in the big picture regional economy here in the Northwest, Oregon in particular, and pass it off to...
Did you state your name for the record?
Josh Lehner with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. Thank you. Apologize for that. And so some big picture items just quickly on the demand side of the equation, and talk a little bit about some of the supply issues we're facing in the housing market that's driving affordability downward, and then pass it off to Mike to talk about some of the more specific items going on in the housing market today. But first off, I wanted to start with this new framework our office has put together, talking about some of the trade-offs that regions face. And this started with the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the nation, going from your New York and Los Angeles of the world all the way down to your Colorado Springs, down closer to the bottom, and maybe your Spokanes of the world in population size. But it really is a framework that faces every community in the nation, in terms of every city wants to have good housing affordability for its residents, but a strong economy and high quality of life. Unfortunately, you can't achieve all three at the same time. There really are trade-offs associated with these three measures. And across the biggest cities in the nation, there's only 8 metropolitan areas that fit in the top half along each of these dimensions. Then there's 10 underlying economic statistical measures here behind these bubbles. It's not just a pretty picture. And the places that do the best on these affordability and quality of life and jobs rankings are in the Great Plains. It's your Omahas and your Des Moines of the world, right? They're just kind of good enough along all dimensions to meet the rankings. And I don't say that discouragingly or disparagingly. I'm from the Great Plains. I'm from Oklahoma, and my whole family and my relatives are still in the Kansas City area, right? But these are my wife jokes. These are great places to be from, not necessarily great places to live today. And so I completed the Oregon Trail 12 years ago myself. The trade-offs we're facing really here in Oregon, and there's a little bit of two different Oregons in terms of the urban and rural disparities. Urban Oregon, Bend in particular, Portland obviously getting the most press in terms of the affordability crunch, have good economies and a very high quality of life. And as such, we're victims of our own success, and the price of housing gets bid up, particularly when we're supply constrained and do not have enough supply on the overall market. So your affordability erodes because the demand is so high to live in a place that's a great place to live and has a good economy. Rural Oregon's a little bit different. Across the rural America, rural Oregon still has a great quality of life. People want to live on the coast, even eastern Oregon and the overall inland west, sort of between the mountain ranges, right? The Sierra Nevadas and the Rocky Mountains, Idaho, Montana, Utah, Nevada, places like that. Great quality of life for rural America. However, the economies are not as robust as in urban Oregon, and they're suffering on the economic front as well, but the affordability erodes at the same time. So this is the big picture framework to talk about some of these issues we're facing in the housing market, and it all really comes down to a lot of demand and population growth. Here in Oregon, people have been moving here ever since Lewis and Clark, even before that as well. Someone left a comment on our website that said, you know, ever since the you had the land bridge to Russia an eon ago, people have been moving to Oregon. And it really is ingrained into the economy of who we are here in Oregon. Every one of your districts, the voting population, 18 and older, is 60 to 70% migrant for U.S. born. Only 30 to 40% of the people in your district were born in the state of Oregon, right? This is ingrained in who we are as a state. It's who we are as an economy. This population growth is tremendously important for overall economic vitality. And by all accounts, population growth has returned. We added as many people in the state of Oregon and in Portland in particular last year as we had at any time in the last couple decades. And it's not just the city of Portland that's booming. More than 2.5 times as many people that moved to the city of Portland last year moved to the suburbs within the Portland metropolitan area. So even though the growth rates are strongest in the urban core, and we've had an urban renaissance in the last 10, 20 years, still disproportionately more people are moving to the suburbs, just because that's where housing is available and the land is most plentiful. So who are some of these people that move to Oregon? The short answer is everyone moves to Oregon across all age spectrums. It's a little bit different across the regions. Rural areas get more towards the retirement community age individuals. They're voting with their feet, saying, I want to live there. They're bringing some wealth with them, being parts of the communities, mostly in southern and central Oregon. In the urban areas, we're getting the young working age households. A lot of them are in their root-setting years, 20s and 30-year-olds. They're unattached. They come often without a job in a U-Haul trailer. But they do integrate into society. They do find a job. The share of young adults, share of millennials today in Portland that has a job is right along, is right there at the median among the 50 largest metropolitans in the area. Sure, Denver and Minneapolis has a little bit more jobs for millennials than we have, but we have more than New York and Los Angeles. So the Portland economy is certainly taking this influx and finding work for them and providing job opportunities over time. About half of these route-setting year people in their 20s and 30s have a four-year degree. So about one out of every four people moving to Oregon today is a young 20 or 30-year-old with a college degree. Then you can separate that even further, and half of them have a technical, scientific, or medical degree, and then half of them have the art degrees or the philosophy degrees or things like that. About half of them do have these technical degrees, which is tremendously important for long-run economic growth. Another thing we're seeing in population growth and household formation and the economy more broadly is sort of this polarization. We see it most prominently on the economic front. We're getting lots and lots and lots of high-wage jobs, doctors and attorneys and consultants and professional service class individuals that have $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year occupations or more. We're also seeing a lot of growth at the low end of the wage spectrum in terms of leisure and hospitality, janitors, agricultural workers by and large, things like that. And you can see it at the household income level too. Here's Eugene. Most of the household growth in Eugene in the last decade has been at the $7,500,000 a year household and above. In Portland, it's even more skewed than this. We've added 60,000 households in the last decade in Portland at $100,000 per household or above. And you can see here their affordability measures, a rough gauge of what they can afford reasonably on that income. It's really, really high. So the question is always like, who can afford these $2,000 or $3,000 a month rents or these $600,000, $700,000? Now it's $800,000 or $900,000 infill homes in the city of Portland. Well, we have a lot more people due to the economic growth and then partly due to the migration that can afford these really high income luxury type properties. So this is one of the aspects that's coming out of the economic growth we've seen in the last decade.
And I'll just note that there's quite a bit of growth at the lower end, and yet I think you're hard pressed to find a rent for $450.
Absolutely. Chair Guinea-Guy, you're absolutely correct. And so when you get down amongst the lowest income households, they're spending, 50, 60, 70, 80% of their income on rent, just due to the fact that they can afford $400 rent, but they can't find something along those lines.
And the standard would be a maximum of 30%.
Exactly. And this is based on 30%, this $400.
Chair Kindergarten, are we doing questions now or at the end?
I think if you have something related to one of the slides.
Yeah, if it's related to the slides, just so we don't lose track. But the when you're talking about people are moving here, I see that in the next slide about the income level, but for the people who are moving here, do we have any sense of can they afford to move here?
Sure.
That's not a very good question because I don't know. I mean, are people moving here and then they arrive and realize, oh my gosh, this is not what I thought. This is more like San Francisco or Seattle or something.
Chair Kindergeyer and Representative Taylor, it's a little bit of both. We always rank number two in the last 5 years on the van lines data, the moving van lines data. And people who move with van lines usually have a job because their employer pays for it. It's not the U-Hauls where you do it yourself sort of thing. So a lot of people are coming here with a job, and so they know the local landscape. However, we do get a lot of those 20 and 30-year-old unattached individuals that just kind of show up, and then they try and make it work from there. And it's also true that disproportionately the people that move don't have jobs, because if you have a good job at a good wage, you're not really going to pack up stakes and leave. You're going to stay wherever you are that have that. So the people that are moving in are disproportionately unemployed or not in the labor force, that sort of stuff, so they have lower income.
Just follow up. Do you have any specific numbers on that, the other half, for the people that are moving in the 20s and 30s? I mean, I represent part of Inner Southeast Portland, and it's a little unclear about some of the folks who are saying they can't afford things. Is it where their whole story, and are they not affording them just because the housing price is too much? Are they underemployed, or are they just not employable? It's a little bit confusing because I receive obviously emails about this subject.
And Chair and Representative Taylor, I think it's going to be a little bit. Again, it's going to be a mixed bag along those lines. I think a lot of it has to do with the affordability. Portland's affordability issues honestly are an extreme case. amongst the 100 largest metropolitans and statistical areas in the nation, our affordability is a lot worse than the other hip, cool metropolitan areas, your Denvers and Seattles and even San Franciscos of the world. Our affordability, a lot of these metrics, is worse than these other places. So even amongst this world of cool places to live, quote unquote, our affordability is lacking. But our economy is also doing the best it's done in 15, 16 years since 2000, I would say. So I think a lot of it comes down to, and I think I'll skip ahead a little bit get back on track in terms of the supply constraint right here. This is number of units built, or at least permits issued, per population growth of people that move here. This is the Portland metropolitan area. It's the 7 county, includes the Vancouver and Washington. When the line goes up, we're building more units per person that moves. When the line goes down, we're building fewer units than are moving here. And overall, we're about 1 year behind on new construction in the Portland metropolitan area, right? So if we just stopped people moving here, or stopped the births and the deaths and the migration and everything, we did 1 year of continuous building, then we would kind of get back to something approaching a functioning housing market. So we're 1 full year behind on new construction, that's over the last 15 years. And I think that is the primary reason that we're having some housing affordability issues. And it's a crunch in a lot of places, close in Southeast Portland being a prime example of that. And this here is our office's demographic forecast for the Portland metropolitan area. If we were to see the same influx of people, according to our forecast, that are moving to Portland each and every day, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 households every day are moving to Portland saying, I need a place to live. These red bars level construction is what we need just to stay on the treadmill, just to stay on the hamster wheel, to keep the current market we're in, and nobody's happy with the current market we're in. So to make a dent and raise our vacancy rates and put pressure on housing to alleviate some of the affordability problems, we need to build more than these red bars. But the red bars are also the same size as what we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years in the Portland metropolitan area. So our office is concerned on the affordability front, given our population forecast. As people look around Portland, I know most members of the committee are from the region. They see a Southeast Division Street or North Williams or a Pearl District or what have you, and they say, oh, we built a lot of apartments. We're good on housing, right? We've had a lot, and we still have a lot in the pipeline. The concern is we need that every single year to meet this demand and this influx of people moving here, because the migration flows have returned in full force. And this is something that has gone on for centuries in the state of Oregon, is people just wanting to move here for quality of life and for the economic reasons. And so this is the big picture stuff that our office puts together, and we usually speak with the Revenue Committee, but I'm happy to chat with you guys and answer any questions you have at any time moving forward. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Any other questions on Josh's presentation? Thank you for coming, and it's good to
I guess
know
I'm sorry, Chair Kindergarten. But so the build, all this construction that's needed, which obviously we need to do, however, it doesn't appear, at least in the Portland area, that there's construction going on, but it isn't affordable for affordable apartments. So that's a tough balance that we have to consider, of how much role the state should be playing in that, because it seems that what's going on, at least in Portland, there's no shortage of people obviously being able to afford these places. And so the market is not saturated. I mean, they build them and people come. I mean, so there doesn't seem to be...
We're doing a better job of meeting the needs
of for the middle and higher.
Right.
And so is that what your research is? Would that support that, or...
Chair Kindergeyer and Representative Taylor, absolutely. Most of the market construction in the last 5 years has been skewed towards the high end. There's no question about it. Mike has a number of slides on that. I got a sneak peek of his presentation previously, so I think I'll let him answer that. But I mean, there's no question that that's where the bulk of the new construction market typically always is, and is even more so in recent years, not at the high end of the market.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And this may be, if I look at the panel, somebody else might actually answer this in their presentation. But, you know, you're saying that we're a year behind as far as trying to keep up and so forth. In the northern part of the state, if you can tell me if this is accurate or not, but southern part of the state, I'm being told by builders that just the permitting process is taking them 3 years sometimes to get through that process in order to build. So even if today we went out and said we have all the locations, everything planned, we still couldn't be caught up in a year. that it's going to take, just to get through the current process, several years to even attempt to scratch at that. Is that the same in the Portland region and so forth?
Representative Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Stark, I hadn't heard the 3 years time frame. That's a little longer than you typically hear in terms of permitting process, so maybe a little quicker in Portland. But again, developers and some of the housing, both advocates and the industry, do cite time lags in the permitting process and different review committees that have to approve the design and what have you, as constraints in terms of, you know, implementation and completion date, that sort of stuff. And I'm not sure if Mike's going to talk about some of those as well, but that is a concern everywhere. But 3 years is considerably longer than I have typically heard.
And so what have you typically heard?
A minimum of 9 months to a year in terms of, you know, when you the idea to when you're actually building the product sort of thing, or certainly completion is about a year out. But those are faster. And so 3 years before you can even put a shovel in the ground again is a little on the certainly on the high end of what I have heard, but I don't doubt that that's what you're being told.
Thank you. Mike.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Michael Wilkerson. I'm a senior economist with Echo Northwest. I'm going to talk a little bit about housing affordability and try to focus in on the ownership product and also a rental product, as those are two distinct but also important problems to address. When we look at single-family affordability, kind of the standard metric that's used is what we call a price-to-income ratio, and that simply takes the median price in an area, in this case, the counties, divided by the income. And a healthy ratio is typically around 3. So the price of the house would be roughly 3 times what your annual family income would be. And you can see throughout the state, most of the state is in those darker blue areas, which are 4 or 5 and even as high as 6. So sometimes double what would be considered a normal healthy range. Some of that is mitigated given that we're in a low interest rate environment. So we're in historic interest rate lows. The price per the homes relative to the monthly mortgage payments are lower. So some of that is explained away. However, when most of the state, both urban and rural, is well over the 3 mark, that's an issue for concern, certainly. If we want to dive deeper down into more of a neighborhood level analysis, what we have here is a map of the Portland inside the urban growth boundary. And this is looking at single family affordability. In each of the hex bins, it takes all of the sales from the calendar year of 2015 and says, what percent of the area median income would I need to be able to afford to purchase a house here? And then this map is with a 20% down payment. So if you could save a 20% down payment, and the average price in the Portland market was about $315,000 during that year, so we're talking $60,000-$65,000 to have a 20% down payment. The areas that are green are less than 30%, which is the traditional assumption for an affordable home. Certainly, you can obtain financing from a financial institution at 30% or below. As you go above 30%, getting financing is simply not possible, and certainly the burden would be much too great. And you can see lots of areas are in the yellow, which is 30 to 40, and the orange, 40 to 50, and in the red area is more than 50% of the area median income, which in 2015, 2016 is about $73,000. So for a family earning $73,000, only the areas in green could you afford a home with a 20% down payment. If we go a little bit further down and we look at with a 5% down payment, which is traditionally where you would think about home ownership in terms of starter homes and being able to save for a home, the map changes quite drastically to where the majority of the map is now in the reds and oranges, and there are very few areas that are below the 30% income threshold. Certainly Representative Taylor is asking about Southeast Portland. You can see at 5% down, there are no areas where it would be affordable or financeable if you were earning the median income. Certainly, if there are questions, I'm happy to field those. I know as an economist, we like to go through numbers very quickly, so please feel free to stop me and I'll try to explain. Earlier, Representative Taylor also asked a question about, you know, how does this stack up nationally? You know, how is Portland compared to other nations, other regions in the nation? So we're currently undergoing a study nationally looking at the impact of affordable housing. And we've kind of categorized each metro, over 200 of them, into kind of high, a medium tier, and a low tier. And that's based on 3 main metrics, the income, the median rent, and then also the construction costs in those markets. And you'll see, you know, certainly there's a big variance difference in income. The average in the high group is about $75,000 on down to the $44,000 range at the low end in the rents accordingly. What we've looked at is how to calculate rental affordability. And this is similar to single family homes in that you take the median rent and you take 30% of your income. And according to HUD, if you're a two bedroom unit, you get 90%. So you get a slight reduction. If you're a five person household, you'd get the full burden. So at the high end of the spectrum, we're San Francisco. 184%. That means you would need almost double the median income in San Francisco to be able to afford the median apartment in San Francisco. And that's certainly well above the thresholds where we like to target for affordability. Boston, 139%. Seattle, 115%. Oftentimes, we're compared to Austin. That's at 100%. So all of those are well above the threshold where when we're looking at affordable housing, generally we're trying to target either 80% of the median or sometimes 60% of the median.
Before you move from that slide, Representative Parrish, did you have a question?
I didn't. I was actually about the last slide and just sort of the 5% down on purchasing. You know, I mean, it just seems after the recession, there's a lot of bankers not offering 5% down mortgages. I mean,
correct.
Is that even a realistic number anymore? Yes.
So from 2011 through 2014, certainly it was not at all available. That the programs are now back both federally and privately funded. So with private mortgage insurance, which is included in the model here, there are some 5% down programs available. But certainly for years after the depths of the recession, that product was not available and it was required to have 20% down.
Didn't know that. Yeah. It went away for a long time, and I just don't see quite as much of that, even if it's out there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be as available. And if you're in a lower credit, you know, risk, 5% is really not available if you're not solid credit.
Correct. We kind of looked at that in Portland, and for FHA loans, which is a 5% down payment, was about 3% of all transactions in 2015 were financed at 5% down. So it's a very, very small part of the market, partially due to what you see there is that the incomes just don't support it. Also, when you have cash buyers and other more equity transactions taking place, they'll outbid the 5% down possibility. So it's certainly tough, but it is plausible that's an option for purchasing a home.
Thanks.
So getting into the Oregon region, in Portland, we're a little bit worse off than Seattle. And again, this is using the medians. And I caution, this is kind of overly optimistic. And I'll look at the new product that's being built on the next slide, and you'll kind of see what's happening. In Bend, it's a little bit better off, down at 103%. So we're in and around Seattle, certainly not as bad as Boston, New York, San Francisco, but better than Austin and lots of other markets, as Josh alluded to in his comments. When we look at where housing gets built, we have this notion of a housing ladder where we have our 0 to 30% of income at the bottom. And this is traditionally our supported, subsidized, regulated market from 0 all the way up to 60% of the median income. Above 80% up through 120% of the median oftentimes is referred to as workforce housing. And that's where we start to see where the market wants to build. What we generally see is ownership product and rental product gets built in what's classified as a luxury demographic. And that's well above the 120% of median income. What happens is through a process of depreciation over time, oftentimes called filtering, new homes are built, and over time they become naturally occurring workforce housing, and sometimes even down as far as moderate income, you know, in and around 100% of AMI. The problem is that when new homes get built, they're not getting built at the what would be considered an affordable level in and around the median income. National studies have looked at this, and they see that for renter product for apartments, this rate is about 2.5% a year, and this is a national study. For ownership product, it's less, at more like 0.5%. Some of that has to do with remodels and renovations and the like for ownership product, but it gives us a sense of how quickly new products come online and how quickly they can become affordable in the market. When we look at Portland specifically, we can see this, and this is kind of the epitome of the problem in the state, is that if we look at the entire market in Portland, the average rent is about $1,250. If we look at development since 2007, it's $725. So it's 38% higher than what the average market is. So when we're building homes, or in this case apartments, at the high end, at the $1,700 a month range, if we look at the previous math where it's 2.5% a year, it would take 10 years for it to depreciate 25%, which still wouldn't even bring new product back to what's considered the median of the market. So if we're looking at building market rate housing as a solution to the supply, certainly it is, and it's the most effective way to do that. However, it is a very long run process to build market rate housing for it to filter its way down to workforce housing. That doesn't happen overnight. And you can see that the premium is pretty large right now in Portland. If we look other areas in the state, we see similar phenomenon in Eugene. The entire market's at 960, built since 2007. We're at 1220, so 27%. Salem, similar. If we looked at Bend, it'd be the same. So it's the case all across the country that new product, both ownership and rental, is priced at a point higher than the average in the market. However, in Portland, that's even more so the case. So if we will look at kind of why that's the case, as the housing recovery has happened, we've started to see construction costs get bid up a lot. And that's partially due to labor inputs, partially due to the raw materials. But as contractors have had lots of work, they continue to bid prices up for construction. And we've seen prices rise by 20-30% over the last 3 to 4 years. The result of that is there are very few areas, even in the city of Portland right now, where apartments are financially viable. So we've looked at a model where if we assume the value of the land is zero, so if you have a long-term landowner with a low-cost basis, and again, this is stacked flat, which is a wood product construction, stick-built, no concrete, no podium, so it's the lowest construction cost. We can see there are limited areas in the market with zero land price where that can be built. And this doesn't include any impacts of inclusionary zoning. This is 100% market rate units. If we look at what's getting built in Portland now, there are a 4-over-1 or a 5-over-1 product. So that's a podium with parking generally, built with steel and concrete. You see these all along Division Williams areas with residential on top, more of a mixed-use product. And the geography of where the rents support that form of construction is even further constrained in the city. And if we want to look at a tower, which is going to be built with steel and concrete, you know, over 5 stories, that geography becomes even smaller. So when we're looking at the problem of where can we build, the answer is not in as many places. And then to further complicate things, if the density isn't allowed by zoning by right in those areas, we can't add the density there. So this is the trade-offs we start to look at when we're looking at what the market wants to do versus the regulation specifically in Portland here.
Do you have slides for if the land value isn't zero? Because the reality is that, you know, I mean, there might be people who own those lots and that they own the land outright, but, you know, most folks aren't going to invest capital to build this type of housing. So then they sell the property. Somebody has to actually now invest money in that land, which is going to change all those numbers around again and certainly tighten the doesn't pencil section when you are talking, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands for, you know, tiny parcels in Portland to sort of build that rack and stack type housing.
Correct. This is a best case scenario with land at zero and no inclusionary zoning. We've recently looked at all of this for the city of Portland, Bureau of Planning Sustainability and their mixed use zones. You know, where in the city can you afford to build certain product types with a density bonus given the land prices, let's say at $100 per square foot, and those areas are few and far in between. So this is part of the challenge is there aren't a lot of sites, and the sites that are available either don't have the rents to command construction, or there's an existing use on the site that's prohibiting construction from happening given that the returns to a private developer are low relative to what the land prices are. So yeah, certainly the buildable land or buildable inventory of sites to add high density development is very low in the city.
And that's also assuming market forces only without any kind of subsidy.
Correct. So some of that gets at what I think are possible policy options to look at improving affordability. And the first is certainly local zoning and regulatory constraints. So that includes things like densities below where the market would want to build, prohibiting certain use types, oftentimes called the missing middle for housing, that can be duplexes, triplexes, quads, garden-style apartments in what is traditionally zoned as single-family neighborhoods, and certainly additional supply that's constrained by urban growth boundaries can all impact housing affordability through the supply-side constraints. tightly knit in with point number one is local infrastructure funding. And this can be things such as mass transportation projects. We know that mass transportation projects alleviate the cost burden for living in areas further away from employment, and certainly they add the increased value of the land. So infrastructure, but then certainly roads and traditional utilities out in areas that they currently aren't serving is the number one constraint to growth in Portland and other areas around the state outside of the urban growth boundaries. If you just expanded the urban growth boundary and didn't couple with that investments in private infrastructure, the cost to build is very high. And again, you're not going to be addressing necessarily affordability in the short run through that process. You certainly can add to the supply of housing. And in the long run, that is the most cost-effective and really only way to improve housing affordability is through the market provision of housing. In the short run, however, without infrastructure costs, you're not delivering product other than through inclusionary zoning or other policies that's targeting anywhere near the median incomes. The third point, I think, is an example of what we could do to take a longer-run approach in economic downturns is look at land banking authorities. Recently, the state has looked at, as you know, the brownfields program, and you could do a similar thing for targeting land. Not necessarily that's a brownfield, although certainly brownfield properties could be eligible, but looking at getting land at a low-cost basis so that we could essentially write down land to close to zero or to areas to where it can support additional affordable housing. Fourth point, construction defect law. As currently written, the construction defect law requires a very high insurance premium in order to be able to fund condominium construction. And when we look at what's being built across the state, the ratio of apartments to condos is massively disproportionately skewed towards apartments. And the primary reason for that is the construction defect law and the insurance policies that are required in order to build condominiums. You have to build a high-quality construction with steel and concrete. The insurance policies associated with each unit to provide you the liability waiver for it so that a developer would build further increase the cost of construction, and it just makes it untenable to build that type of product when the investment community is bidding down the cap rate or increasing the value for apartment units. You just don't see condos being built. Similarly, in terms of cost savings building, we can look at prefab or modular homes. Similarly, the law is unclear as to how construction defect applies to those types of prefab. So those types of loopholes could help make lower cost construction more feasible. And the final one is looking at low-income housing tax credits. Certainly looking at the process for which they are distributed amongst the state could be better targeted geographically rather than looking at a county-wide. We can look much more targeted areas where that's not currently happening.
Representative Parrish.
Can I ask about something that I don't see on the list? And, you know, I've read a little bit about, we're not doing it here, but you know, sort of similar to we want people to carpool, right, and not eat up lanes. You have a lot of housing stock in particular like large cities, maybe older homes where you really just have like still one person living at home. Everybody's moved out and you've got, you know, somebody there and just living by themselves. It's a 2 or 3 bedroom home. You know, what's being looked at to maybe incentivize folks who want to make modifications that would allow a part of that to become a rental, not a typical duplex type unit, but to, you know, increase housing stock that way. And there are some cities, I think, trying to tackle more of a shared housing model for people who are sort of empty nesters. And but I, you know, I'm not hearing that as part of our affordable housing conversation. And certainly you drive through neighborhoods in Portland that are older. And, you know, there is, you know, maybe the husband died and the kids have moved out and grandma lives there by herself and she's trying to find a way to stay in her home. And but the home by itself wouldn't, you know, as it's currently designed, wouldn't allow for the privacy piece, you know. So what are we talking about? I mean, are you paying attention to what other cities are doing to try to incentivize that type of construction, remodel construction that would allow for sort of a subdivision of an existing house?
Yeah, certainly. So that falls under our missing middle housing. I mean, certainly accessory dwelling units are, you know, there's been policies in Portland specifically to target reduction in system development charges to make those more affordable to build. And I think that's a key component to adding density without necessarily changing the built environment per se. Mm-hmm. However, you know, there are primarily tax concerns with that. If you're getting reassessed as you change the use of a property, that can be a large burden. So again, those are, you know, coordinated policies to help things like adding density through ADUs or other subdivisions are certainly a good way to do that.
But I would just add to Representative Parrish's idea, I've been hearing a lot of support for this as well. In some cases, not even increasing density, it's taking an existing building and fitting more people.
Well, fitting more people, but designed in such a way that, you know, maybe you're right. Little kitchen's over here, your bathroom's over right. here, or whatever, and you're in the same space, or common living space, or whatever. I mean, there's lots of ways to design it out, but if you're grandma and you're struggling to pay your tax bill in Portland, even if that felt like an option and you wanted to sort of carve out some space in an existing house for you, you might not have the cash flow to actually do that type of space that maybe lets a mom with a single child, you know, I mean, or a single mom with a child move into that house and sort of have a co-generational housing model.
It could allow some of the beautiful old historic structures to stay and yet accommodate more people. And I know I just got back from Scotland and they're turning a lot of their old palaces and castles into either hotels or flats. I think it's a really interesting model. To
Queen
see
Anne
what
High
we
School
do.
In Seattle is all, you know, they turned that old high school into
should keep track
space,
of what we
right?
might do to incentivize.
Dollars now to buy a
corner. Yeah, and certainly the sharing economy is doing some of that, yeah. right? You have your yeah. Airbnbs and the yeah. like who are renting out, you know, parts of spaces that are informally dedicated to other uses. So there's lots of approaches for that.
Specifically, I'm looking, though, at incentives to take somebody mm-hmm. who might otherwise not have the cash flow and yep. the capital to make a $20,000 yep. improvement or whatever to their home that lets, you know, let that co-generational housing model type work.
Yeah, we're working with the city of Austin on a project looking at specifically, they call them alley flats there. Essentially, we call them ADUs here, but looking at a revolving loan fund that subsidizes the down payments to make those modifications that can be paid back over a relatively short period of time to make that more financially viable.
Great. So is that it for your presentation?
That's it.
That's great.
Right,
thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much. We continue to look ahead. We have to get at all the cost drivers. So I appreciate that. And our next panel is Kurt Krieger from City of Portland Housing Bureau and John Williams, Deputy Director of Metro. I recognize here that we wanted to take a big statewide picture at the cost drivers and then zero in on kind of a local look, and we will have time to look at rural areas another time. But I think it's really interesting to kind of take a more micro look now and see what's happening at your level.
Absolutely. Local. Thank you, Chair Kennegeier, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Krieger. I'm director of Portland's Housing Bureau. And in Portland City Government, Commissioner Dan Saltzman is not just responsible for the Housing Bureau, but he's also responsible for the Bureau of Development Services. So we have a sister bureau for which we work through a lot of issues related to throughput of permits and regulatory reform. So I'll touch on a few of those issues since there seems to be some interest in that. What I thought I would do today specifically is give you a snapshot. You've heard about Portland from me during session. You've heard about Portland just now, so I'm not going to repeat any of that. But the Housing Bureau has a portfolio of affordable housing. And when I was hired last fall, Commissioner Saltzman asked me to do a deep dive with the City Council to explain why it is that affordable housing costs so much. And I was given about 3 weeks to do that, which is plenty of time for a new guy. And, you know, I've worked in the university. I've worked in Seattle. I've worked in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. I've done this work for about 40 years. So in a very quick period of time, we surveyed all the national data. As it turns out, the state of Washington and the state of California has gone quite to great lengths. The Washington legislature required the Department of Commerce to do a complete review of their housing trust fund. The trust fund funds projects under 50% of median income. California Tax Allocation Committee did a similar thing for a much larger sample size for the state of California, specifically looking at affordable housing. So most of my comments today are going to be focused on affordable housing per se, but I'd be happy to render an opinion on some other things and some of the cost containment strategies apply to both affordable and market rate housing. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the so-called GATOR process, which is the Governmental Accountability and Transparency Review underway in Portland. So what's the national data show us? There is a basket of costs, if you will. Hard costs, which you might call sticks, bricks, and land, constitutes about 77% of the total cost of new construction. And that's a median of all the data that we looked at nationwide. And I've given staff access to the source documentation for this report. The soft costs, which includes interest, profit and overhead, developers' fees, various reserve funds, constitute some 14% of the cost of housing. And what I call social benefit costs constitutes about 9% of the total. And as I explained to the Portland City Council, the social benefit costs are in large part in the control of local or state government. The hard and soft costs are often external costs. They're market realities. They're set by national capital markets. It's what it costs, although you might be able to bend the cost curve slightly in hard and soft costs. The real breakthroughs are probably in the social benefit costs. So, as I mentioned, sticks, bricks, and land, hard cost contingency, furniture, fixtures, and equipment all constitute hard costs. Architecture, engineering, I used to work for OTAC, not just in Portland, but Denver, Seattle, and Phoenix. A&E costs what it costs to prepare working drawings for complex buildings. Interest carry, property taxes during the course of construction, and project management expenses. Soft costs, and some people are often challenged by why it costs so much, but soft costs includes reserves, debt service reserves, lease up and operating reserves, which can be significant in the capital markets, legal expenses, developer fees, marketing, and soft cost contingency. The social benefit costs include a range of things: prevailing wages, sustainability, including the certification that you meet sustainability standards, design review and compliance, and then a host of different policy implications. Trip reduction, for example, community gardens, green walls, green roofs, minority and women-owned business subcontracting requirements, and workforce participation or workforce development programs. So these are all ancillary benefits, and I don't challenge the merit of any of these. They all have a reason. They're all connected to affordable housing because public dollars are being spent, and people want to leverage more than just housing with their public benefit dollars. But I do think it's important for people to realize what it does cost. You're making a decision. It should be a conscious decision, not an unconscious decision. There are several techniques that can be used to manage hard costs. One is something we call design build. This is where a team, a developer, an architect, an engineer essentially works with the capital markets to deliver a completed project. OTAC did a lot of design build internationally. We did the Ritz-Carlton Hotel of 550 rooms in Abu Dhabi. We did the construction and the construction management at risk. We had to deliver a completed hotel to the principality. Turnkey acquisition of completed projects. This is where instead of doing design, bid, build, where you have a design, you bid it, you build it, you basically buy a completed project turnkey, hence the name. And that is you agree to buy a unit price upon completion. The developer and the contractor takes the risk of actually producing that unit, but their reward for having done so is that fixed price determination. And I would argue that in this market, everybody's pretty busy. So getting people to look at turnkey is probably not the right time. However, at the backside of a busy market such as we have, it will become appropriate at some future point.
And that's where the capital gains tax, cutting it out could be a big help in this particular strategy.
Indeed, and I've done a couple of different turnkey projects over the years. It's you need a developer with $20 or $30 million of headroom in their budget for which they can produce affordable housing. Some have that, others don't. The maximum allowable cost contract, instead of design build, you basically have an agreed upon price. There's a penalty if you don't meet that price. It does mean that you have to be extremely specific about your specifications. The building has to be essentially designed to be able to enforce a maximum allowable cost contract. And as mentioned earlier, land banking, to the extent that land is a factor in the hard cost basket of goods, controlling that land volatility is important. Soft cost includes a host of things, having common standards between different funders, be they state, federal, or local, would be a great improvement. Contingent loan agreements, where there's some, and this is used in Portland, whereby the city of Portland backs Home Forward, the housing authority serving Portland and Multnomah County. They issue bonds, but the city office of finance stands behind those bonds and agrees to lend them money if they need it. That allows them to get those bonds investment grade rated and lowers their cost of building. Or their cost of interest. Design build, again, can reduce soft costs as well as hard costs. You saw it in the example of hard costs, but it's a way to also reduce soft costs. The social benefit, and this is one area, since I briefed the city council on this last fall, where we've spent the most time. Design review, and I was a fairly vocal critic early on about the lack of certainty in Portland's design review process. Projects seem to go into design review, they never seem to come out. That is that they would be amended multiple times before they were approved, and they were never denied. Had they been denied, they would have gone to city council on appeal and would likely have been approved very quickly, but they cycled through design review multiple times. And there was not a factor of cost or cost control within the design commission's charge, which I think was maybe a missing link. So I can talk to you a little bit towards the end about how we have changed design review. I think it's important that you know that the Bureau of Labor and Industries does apply a commercial wage determination on five-story buildings, whether or not they have any commercial use in them whatsoever. And that is a policy interpretation. It's not a statute. We think it's perhaps a costly interpretation, which could lead to more affordable housing were it to be determined that 4-over-1 buildings with no commercial component were deemed residential. Let me give you a good case in point. There's a project called the Yards at Union Station. It's developed by Skip Grodal, GSL Properties in Portland. It's 1,200 units and built in five phases. The first phase, phase one, was developed by Skip Grodal under the residential wage rate as deemed by Boley. The fifth phase, next to the Burnside Bridge, it spans Broadway to Burnside, 1,200 units, next to the Union Pacific Railroad tracks. The last three phases were deemed to be commercial. Well, they don't. They're not any different. They have no difference in material construction. It's a wage determination that Boley has made. And this applies as to whether or not you have a retail use, which would be deemed commercial, versus a building amenity such as an office, a workout room, or perhaps a community room. So I alert you to that because we think a split wage determination where just the commercial portion of the building would be appropriate versus the entire building. We have an internal debate going on about sustainability in Portland. We have been an early adopter for leadership in energy and environmental design, but we recognize that the compliance with LEED and especially the certification of LEED is quite costly. So we're developing a new standard and a new approach.
Before you go on too much,
yes.
Thank you. And I want to go back to the wage piece because this did come up in our ABC work group. It was something that I mean, people felt kind of strongly about. I think that the requirements around wages when we're looking at this affordable housing, it's not that anybody doesn't want people to be paid a fair wage, but that it absolutely is a constraint. And I heard that from some of the advocates, and I heard that from some of the builders in the room. It was, sort of a tough spot to be in, right? Because you do want people to be paid well for the job that they're doing, but that it absolutely was a factor. So that is something I hope we do address, is how do we wrap our heads around bringing down the actual cost of building, and labor was significant part of that, one of those discussions. So.
A split wage determination would still allow that commercial portion of the building to be built under commercial wage rates. And as is often the case in a mixed-use building, only 20% of the building is commercial, 80% is residential. we're going to see more of this because we're upzoning all the transit corridors in Portland. We're adding zoning capacity for 123,000 new housing units, and most of that will occur in commercial zones in a mixed-use typology. So there could be a lot of gains in this area.
Yep. We've taken Representative Evans.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. One of the things that I hope to be able to be in a position to facilitate a conversation on in 17 that relates to, I think, your next slide, or I thought I saw, well, maybe it was last slide. Anyway, the costs. One of the things that I would like to see, or at least I'm hoping to see, is ways to encourage, especially multiple use, larger structures, having alternative energy generation, not merely energy efficiency, but actually adding power to the grid for both a emergency management resilience component investment, as well as, quite frankly, a new revenue stream that could help long-term buy the cost down of some of the investments being made. I know that LEED is designed to try to make the building the best, possiblest, smallest impact possible, but if we could look at the other side of the ledger, perhaps the end goal would be perhaps more clean energy into the grid.
Well, you may know, Representative Evans and members of the committee, that REACH CDC has developed a net zero project in the Orenco Station area of Hillsboro. I think there's promise in that area. They've been a market leader. In most of our efforts, we've been recognizing that the building envelope, there's energy savings. The green roof certainly has some opportunities for solar, hot water, and that sort of placement. We've not gone to the next level of net zero, but that's, I think, a logical next step.
I think Representative Evans always has very creative ideas. I know we're looking more at permanent affordable housing here, but I know that you've recently been developing ideas around emergency housing, and how can we bring down some of the labor costs by having the Oregon National Guard do this as part of their volunteer commitment. So thank you for all these ideas.
Temporary housing.
For temporary, right, for the emergency or temporary housing. Right.
We always think it's worth talking about workforce development. We do promote women, minority, and disadvantaged small business participation in all of our programs. And frankly, we often exceed 30% participation. That comes at a cost, and I think it's important just to keep that cost, you know, on the dashboard so that you know that it's a social benefit that you're achieving through housing development programs. So what's this GATOR? The Governmental Accountability and Transparency Review is something that Portland uses to try to develop interdepartmental efficiencies. And it's convened by the mayor, facilitated by the Office of Management and Finance. And in this particular example, this winter, as we were going through our legislative session, we were also retooling our permit process. Because the Housing Bureau had moved some $61 million out for public bid through a notice of funding availability, we wanted to make sure that the projects that we funded were implemented in a more timely fashion than perhaps had historically been the case. We specifically looked at changes to design review. Under the state of emergency, you might recall when I spoke with you this last session, the city of Portland had declared a state of emergency that allows us some modification to zoning and regulatory changes. And under that state of emergency, a short-term fix to design review was instituted, and that is that affordable housing developers funded by the Housing Bureau have a fork in the road. They can go to Type 3, which involves the complete public review process in front of the Design Commission, or they can go to a Type 2X, and the Type 2X is a staff review appealable to the Design Commission. And that might sound like six and one, half a dozen of the others, but we think we can save between 4 and 6 months in this process. The River Place Parcel 3, which is a large mixed-use, mixed-income project in the South Waterfront, is the first project that's going through the Type 2X process. It's being co-developed by Williams & Dane Development and Bridge Housing, a nonprofit. It's about 147 affordable units. 147 market rate units, about 200 affordable units. So it's a large project with a retail ground floor. so we'll test that. Then the state of emergency is set to expire, will likely be extended by the current mayor, but nonetheless, it is set to expire. So the city council, when establishing this, asked for a report back from Planning and Sustainability, the Bureau of Development Services, and the Housing Bureau in October about what permanent fixes should be put into place. And in that regard, we're looking at sustainability, specifically LEED, and at lower cost means of certifying compliance with sustainability standards. I would say that we've made a lot of progress in certain very arcane areas. areas, which is getting the PGE and PP&L on the same page with respect to vaults and the design specification of electric transformers, because these are often upon the election of the utilities, they would like them within a building. The Design Commission has stipulated that they're not to be in buildings, they're to be in the public right-of-way. Oh, that therefore often places these vaults under sidewalks. They have to be handicapped accessible, and therefore we have to have a design standard that everybody agrees to. So we're making good progress, and the whole goal is to essentially improve the throughput of affordable housing within the city of Portland. And to the extent that we can rewire processes and make it better for everybody, that's our goal. I think there were some questions a little bit about accessory dwelling units. I was chief of housing and economic development for Metro King County for about 10 years. We did fund a program called Home Sharing for Seniors. It was mostly within North Seattle, and that is where our local community development corporation served as the intermediary between a homeowner, often a single person, very often female, and a person that would share that space with them. We do have a proposal in Portland from an ecumenical organization to do something very similar. We're working through the issues of liability right now, because if we make a match and the match goes bad, we obviously want to make sure that we understand what the risk factors are. As far as accessory dwelling units are concerned, Portland has been promoting ADUs. We do waive system development charges for accessory dwelling units, either within or detached from the unit. That's worth about $24,000, and we have a two-year sort of provision. As we have been working through the construction excise tax issue, which was authorized this last session, Commissioner Salzman announced today what that will look like, and we are proposing that we would exempt not just the state qualified exemptions, but any improvements under $100,000 and ADUs for a period of at least 2 years. So we don't want to add fees on top of ADUs because we're promoting their promulgation throughout the city of Portland. I'd be happy to respond to any other questions that you might have.
Representative Harris. A little bit different topic, but it does definitely relate to housing. What is your relationship like with Portland Public Schools? And I ask because, you know, as housing continues to sort of be built on the west side and we're doing, you know, a lot of big buildings, there's some angry mamas out there who aren't real happy that their kids are getting, you know, districted and bused all over the place. I mean, is there any thought as these buildings are going in and City of Portland is improving them and working with Portland Public Schools, and maybe you've got K through 2 on the ground floor or second floor of one of these buildings, you know, and kids are just riding the elevator up and down to their classroom, you know, in these types of facilities? I mean, it just seems like there's this huge, like, where our education is at, and we're not really building a lot of new schools, and where the housing is are in two different, entirely different places, and there just seems to be a lot of frustration about, you know, kind of the combination of housing and schools in the city of Portland. And so how much dialogue are you having with Portland Public Schools around trying to match the needs of housing and schools without having kids get bused, you know, kind of all over City of Portland?
I'd say
question, and I'm going to say please answer it quickly, because
yes,
I do want to give you enough time, and I want to turn to child welfare by 4.
Excellent.
So we could go on for a long time. Yeah. I know.
Representative Parrish, members of the committee, we're dovetailing pretty well, I think, between Portland Public Schools and the city. That it means to say that this current redistricting effort included both Matthew Scheibold, who's the policy and equity manager for the Housing Bureau, and Joe Zender, the chief planner. So they were actually part of the Citizens Advisory Committee on restructuring. That said, I think in retrospect, you could conclude that Northwest Portland needed another school. It needed another school probably to be sited 10 years ago, so that as the River District built out, the Pearl built out, that there would actually be school property available. It's probably a lesson learned for our master planning of the post office in downtown Portland. For those of you that haven't been following this, the city of Portland is financing some $88 million to secure the 14-acre site. That 14-acre site is got a zoning entitlement for 4 million square feet of space, 2 million square feet of housing, about 3,000 units, and 2 million square feet of office. campus. Very appropriate to consider an urban school, I think, in a footprint of that size. The North Park blocks will be extended through the property, so there's quite a lot of public infrastructure to be paid for. But the zoning densities are such that we think that the and the Housing Bureau is an equity participant in this acquisition. So we will ensure that a third of those units are affordable. So about 800 to 1,000 affordable units out of the 3,000 that are planned will be included. Since it bridges the Old Town Chinatown and the River District, it could be a good location for something like that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
I also want to note that Representative Ken Helm is here. As a member of the Land Use Committee, it's good for us to have that cross-sectional. Thank you for joining.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yep. Okay. John Williams.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is John Williams. I work for Metro in the Planning and Development Department. There's a good side and a bad side, and going last on the panel, right? And a number of the points that I wanted to make have already been made, and so I think I'll move through them pretty fast. And maybe touch on some of the relationship between land use and urban growth boundaries and housing affordability in this, because I know that's a topic that comes up. There's a lot of different opinions on that, and as you see, our view is that there are a lot of different stories about what supply and demand mean. There certainly is a supply and demand story going on here, but my main point, I think, is to differentiate between the supply of land and the supply of housing. They're very, very different. You've heard from earlier presenters some of the challenges of getting land ready for the market to utilize or for the public sector to utilize in some cases. We have land available in our region, and the real challenge, we think, is making that land market ready. Sometimes we use the comparison to the difference between crude oil and gasoline. You can have a crude oil oversupply. If you don't have the refineries, you don't have enough gasoline. It's a similar story to that. Getting land ready for the market is a very challenging thing. And so I will just start off really briefly. A lot of conversation about land use and the role of land use regulations. You may have seen a study that's gotten a lot of attention issued by Josh Furman, who is the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, titled Barriers to Shared Growth: The Case of Land Use Regulation and Economic Rents. And this has been waved around quite a bit by folks that have an interest in affecting land use regulations. But the piece actually is a lot different than a lot of folks think it is. In Oregon, we have this system where within urban growth boundaries, we make land ready for development. There are a lot of places in this country where that is not the case, in cities where there are regulations designed to prevent housing from happening. And so there's this distinction between the kinds of land use regulation that are designed to prevent development and the kinds that are designed to facilitate development. You'll see a couple of quotes here. It's the prohibitions on multifamily housing that was really the focus of this report. Here's a couple more quotes. They talk a little bit about the demand, the desire for Americans to live in urban areas. And again, the main theme of the report, multifamily housing units are the form of housing supply most often the target of regulation. It's really what that report is getting at. And so
I've heard it referred to as, I think he uses the term exclusionary zoning policies.
Exactly. And we certainly do have challenges. You've heard about some of the challenges in making urban development happen in this region. You know about them as well. But I just wanted to make that point. This is another way of looking at some of the data you saw earlier from Josh and Mike. And I think what it really emphasizes, what you see here is the change in incomes and rents for both owners, or that is housing price on the ownership side and rent on the apartment side. And while there certainly is a variety of challenges for ownership, the problem is most extreme in the realm of renters. And it's our view that what we really need to focus on is, in this market, is building rental properties in locations that are central, that have access to good jobs and transportation. We believe that that trend is likely to continue for some time as well. Economic forecasts that we see and that we have produced show that new households in the future are likely to be smaller households. They're likely to be headed by older people over time, more and more, and the incomes will be lower. And so we think the demand for this market type is going to continue for quite some time. You saw a version of this earlier from Josh. I won't touch on it. It just really addresses that we had this crunch where housing wasn't being built, but our region continued to be a place where people wanted to move. So we had population growth unabated, we had housing that definitely abated, and this is one of the causes of the housing crisis that we're seeing right now. I think it's important to make the point that we are not alone in this. I testified during the session and showed a slide of a headline from Houston, a city not known for its land controls, and talking about the affordability crisis in downtown Houston, if you can believe it. That proved to be somewhat of a popular present slide, and since then, people keep sending me stories from other places. And so what we have seen is that in almost every city around the country, regardless of their land use regime, there is a housing crisis. People are looking for close-in locations. People are looking for rentals. And so the trends that we're experiencing in this region, although we, of course, have some unique components to it, they're similar everywhere. And, yes, I do have two slides full of these. And we left out all the ones from other places around the world. It's happening all over the place as well. It's important to note that many of these places actually do have the kinds of restrictions that I was talking about earlier that make it difficult to build condos, apartments in downtown locations. So Oregon has the benefit, has a number of advantages in place. We have planned ahead. We have created a state land use system, created requirements for local governments where we require the provision of opportunities for housing. For example, cities, Metro is required to provide a 20-year land supply for all uses, including housing. And we are also required to review that supply and the forecast demand every 6 years. We just completed that last year. The Metro Council adopted the most recent findings and committed to doing another one of those studies in 3 years. We're only required to do them every 6 years. The Metro Council wants to do another one in 3 years just to make sure that the land supply is not the key factor obstructing the market. We also, just thinking about statewide, the state housing goal, state planning goal 10, gets even more specific and requires jurisdictions to encourage the availability of housing for people throughout the spectrum of income and affordability. So we have a great situation where we are doing the work. The land is available, and we need to implement those plans. Just to talk a little bit about where development has and hasn't happened, and I think most of the rest of my presentation is a few photos of what's happening in our region. Most of the new homes in our region have been built in existing areas recently. 93% of residences in the last 10 years were built inside the urban growth boundary as it stood in 1979. Even though the Metro Council has added over 30,000 acres to the UGB since then, you see the demand in our centers, not just Portland, also Hillsborough and Beaverton, Wilsonville, a lot of development happening inside our existing communities. And so just some pretty pictures here. Where is the growth happening? Mississippi Avenue in Portland. So this is an 8-year change in these places. Pearl District. Lloyd District in Hillsborough. The difference in Orenco. If you haven't been to Orenco recently, it's quite amazing what is happening out there. And infill and redevelopment all over the place. As I mentioned, Metro Council has added land to the urban growth boundary over time. We think these expansions are a key part of our toolbox moving forward. You'll see that land has been added adjacent to every jurisdiction that has an edge over time. Again, 30,000 acres. And our recent assessment of supply shows that we have room for about 400,000 new units under our current zoning in this region without any upzoning and without amending the urban growth boundary. And that includes capacity for approximately 40,000 single-family homes right now in the supply that we have. Again, in areas added to the urban growth boundary since 1998, only about 8% of the planned housing has been built. And we knew that those areas would be challenging to develop. It's not that we thought that would happen instantly. There have been a tremendous number of challenges, many of which you've heard about in this committee. The legislature last year made it a little bit easier to annex land to cities. That's going to help a lot. Annexation was one of the key challenges for cities. But you also heard earlier about infrastructure. That is really the key driver. The federal government has disinvested in infrastructure. infrastructure, the state and the region are going to need to step up. We have a real challenge providing infrastructure to the places that have been added. Again, before I move on, I just want to note that the council thinks that these lands that are being added are an important part of our regional plan, and the council has allocated millions of dollars in grant funding to cities and counties around the region to get the places that have been added ready. We stand ready to help with that. We think it's an important part of our housing supply. Just want to take you really briefly through some of the places that have been added. And if you keep your eye on the index map on the bottom left, you'll see these places. These are current photos in many of the places that have been added. To illustrate how long it takes to get these places ready for development, for the market to utilize. Pleasant Valley added in 1998. I won't go into detail on Damascus. If you're dying to ask me questions, I'll happy to answer them. But Damascus added in 2002. Areas outside of Oregon City, 14 years on. That's a place that's experienced annexation challenges for sure. In Wilsonville, Wilsonville has had some of the main successes in developing land. Their Vilbois development has been very popular, but there are some vacant lands still available there. Coffee Creek is still working through the development cycle on Brookman Road in Sherwood. South Cooper Mountain, this is a photo that's probably a little bit out of date. There is some development happening on South Cooper Mountain now. It's been many years in the works. South Hillsboro, also, we're hoping to see work start out there pretty soon. That's been a place that's been extremely challenging to finance the infrastructure. Hillsboro has a is very on top of it, though, and is working very hard to provide the financing for that infrastructure. So that'll be another success story soon. The David Hill area was added in 2002 in this area. So won't take any more of your time. These are all places that have been added over time. The last point I want to make about affordability in these urban growth boundary expansion areas, it's been challenging to provide affordable housing. In Bethany, this, I think I have a, yes I do. So here's a townhouse in Bethany priced at $400,000. With the cost of development out there, with the market demand, when we add land outside the when we bring it in, it's also challenging to make that affordable out there, and we need tools for that as well. The last slide I just want to show you is that the Metro Council is very committed to taking on the affordability issue. Here's a few things that we have underway, some of which you may be involved in as well. We have started an equitable housing initiative. We've convened partners in this region to talk about the affordability housing problem, to identify solutions, and to gain consensus to come and take those on. That may include legislative approaches, so you may hear more from our coalition over time. As I mentioned earlier, Metro Council has planning and development grants. Our next round of grants is targeted specifically at cities and counties to provide affordable housing solutions. So there's going to be a round of those grants this year available. We're working on housing plans in the corridor plans that we're doing, Southwest Corridor from Portland out to Tualatin and Tigard, and on Powell Division in Portland. We've assembled a Brownfields Coalition, recently got some EPA grants to do Brownfields assessment on some of the land that could be revitalized on the McLaughlin Corridor and in other places around our region. The final piece that I've mentioned, that I'll mention, is a task force that Metro Council President Tom Hughes has convened with 18 folks from our region, including a dozen mayors from various cities, county chairs, the Home Builders Association, Thousand Friends of Oregon, to look at some of the challenges that were identified in our last review of the urban growth boundary and to find ways to make that process more effective. And we know that there are some, it's a difficult process to bring land into the UGB. We want to make that easier for cities when they have plans in place, when they have financing and governance identified. We want to make those places relatively easy for places for cities to bring into the urban growth boundary. So with that, that's what we're up to. Right before 4 o'clock, I have 1 minute for questions.
Yeah, I've got two questions here. So Representative Evans first and then Representative Pierce.
The question I have is, and it could be yes, no, but is Metro positioned so that hypothetically there's a downturn in the economy, and instead of this time allowing the builders not to be able to build and have that capacity not move when they've got overcapacity, is it possible that we could take a lesson from defense planning and actually target areas throughout Metro, maybe the harder areas to get development during good times, to continue building capacity for the high volume, multi-use, multi-family type dwellings? If it's such a big capacity, could we go through you as a basically a provider during downtimes to basically have a jobs program?
Chair Kenny Guy or Representative Evans, I'm not entirely sure.
Legally.
Legally?
Yeah, this grant project you just talked about. Do you have the authority?
Our grants are targeted at planning and development, not at construction. Right now, construction isn't actually an eligible use. What the council intends to do is make areas available for development by doing assessments, by doing market feasibility studies and work such as that.
But if you had statutory language to do such a thing, it would match up to the planning, theoretically?
I'm not entirely sure that I understand the question.
Talk offline.
We can talk offline. I think we'd be happy to do that. Metro is definitely open to being part of the solution on these issues.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. So I represent Clackamas and Stafford. And I have to say, when I talk to builders, when I talk to my county commissioners, when I talk to people in my community, there is a very prevalent belief that our UGB system is causing the affordable housing crisis, because a half an acre dirt in my district goes for $500,000 to $750,000, and you're not building anything affordable there. And so this sort of artificial scarcity lock on our land system is sort of allowing people who are landowners to drive up the price of land. So how do you as Metro respond to that? Because I know that this is a bipartisan complaint on my county commission and the Clackamas side, and certainly when you see reports in the Oregonian that we are not just short housing land, or the perception is we are short housing land, we are also short large tract development land for jobs near infrastructure. And when you, most of the people in my county are commuting to somewhere else outside of my county for work. So what does Metro say to that? And I know there is this rub right now happening with Metro and Clackamas. How do we fix this? Because it's really frustrating to me as a legislator to hear it all the time from folks in my district. You couldn't build anything affordable in Westland even if you wanted to, because of the cost of land.
Chair Kenny Guy, Representative Parrish, excuse me. Those are really important questions, and I think where I would answer that in a couple of ways. One is the constraint on land supply is, I want to make clear that it's a 20-year supply that we're required to keep in place at all times. So I mentioned that we have capacity for 400,000 dwelling units, according to our recent assessment, inside the urban growth boundary. Again, that includes 40,000 single-family home capacity on vacant land right now. And so I think the challenges are more about providing infrastructure to the land that folks would like to develop than it is about adding more land. It's my belief that if we added more land to the UGB, it would just create more places that cities don't have the resources to bring roads and sewer and water to. The Metro Council has indicated an interest in adding lands to the UGB when cities have plans to provide the services that could make those areas market feasible. I think it's really the provision of infrastructure that has been the largest challenge. We went through a process in our region that you're very familiar with, the urban and rural reserves, to identify the 50-year supply of places to be added. The Metro Council has grant funding set aside for cities to take on the planning for those urban reserves when they identify it. In the last cycle, we received one application. That was from Sherwood to do that work. So most of the cities that have UGB boundary on them are not focused on adding more land. They're focusing on getting land ready that they already have. So that's one answer. I think you also raised industrial and employment lands. We have more flexibility in our system to add industrial and employment land in our region. It's more challenging to add residential land because there are more rules. And so the assessment is more complicated. The standards are higher. We do have the ability to be more flexible in adding land to the UGB on employment. And I think there the real challenge is finding flat, you mentioned large site industrial, and that's an important part. It's a sort of a niche part of our economy in our region. We need to have those sites available. The challenge is finding places that are flat and developable that cities can serve with infrastructure. There is a real shortage of those around the region, only a couple of places that are in those urban reserves. The council does have the ability to bring those in already.
Well, I want to thank you. I know we can go on for hours and hours about this. I think that the data is excellent. The photographs are excellent. I know there's a lot of thoughts about different cost drivers, and it was helpful to have some real data here about a variety of different cost factors and comparing Oregon to other places that don't have UGB as a potential one of those cost factors. So I think some of this was in response to some of the questions that had continually come up, and I hope Rep. Bueller was able to listen in, because he was one of the people that wanted to have this discussion. This is not the end of the discussion. I know it's an ongoing discussion, but I really appreciate some of the big picture thinking around what some of the real cost drivers are, because we certainly have a lot of them that we do need to deal with. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on housing cost drivers, open up the DHS and child welfare oversight informational hearing. So Director Clyde Psyche and Dr. Reginald Richardson. Thank you. Sorry, we're a little past four.
Okay.
I know you're very practiced at this by now.
Chair Kinnegeyer and Vice Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, I'm the interim director for the Department of Human Services. And with me...
Until tomorrow.
Hopefully.
Tomorrow is the confirmation.
Yeah.
He's not going away. It's a confirmation.
We already discussed.
Can't leave, man.
He's not leaving. He's going to be confirmed. It's permanent tomorrow.
Representative Stark, Vice Chair Stark and
didn't
I
mean
have
to scare
this
everyone.
Discussion.
Didn't mean to scare everyone.
On several different occasions, and I always tell him that I'm the interim director until confirmed by the Senate, and I never assume anything until the deal is
They're not going to let you off, man.
His sentencing is coming tomorrow.
So it was really interesting, actually, because I introduced myself as the interim director to another group, and one of the people in the group after the meeting came back and said, does that mean that if the Senate doesn't confirm you, you go back to being the DAS director? And I said, I don't know.
Yeah. We're not going to entertain that possibility right now. Thank you.
Yeah. Debbie's like, no.
So Dr. Richardson and I are here today to give you an update on child welfare and talk about several other issues. I'm going to start because we've had several leadership changes since we last met with you, and I think it's important for you to be brought up to date. I'm going to talk about some organizational changes and a couple other points, and then I'm going to give an update on the external assessment on child welfare that the governor asked for. And then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Richardson, and he's going to talk about some opportunities and challenges on the child welfare side. So first, just leadership changes. One of the changes that I'm very excited about is I asked Dr. Richardson to step in to the role of deputy director, and he agreed. Unfortunately, or fortunately, shortly after I asked him to assume that role, I decided to make some changes in child welfare leadership and had a couple of our senior leaders in child welfare step down. It left kind of a hole in our leadership team. So I asked Dr. Richardson to step into the role of interim child welfare manager, and so he asked me the question instead of deputy director, and I said, no, that's not how it works around here. You actually get to do both jobs for a while. So we are actually recruiting for a new child welfare director, and Dr. Richardson would be happy to talk to anybody who's interested, and he often reaches out to people. We really would like to fill that position as quickly as possible because we do need that certainty and we need the person to assume the leadership position to move
us
forward. And
Clyde, you have a national search going on?
Chair Kenny Geyer, yes, we have a national search and we also have an executive recruiter out of the Department of Administrative Services who's doing personal outreach to people who are referred to us and people he comes in contact with. So
who is head of self-sufficiency now that Dr. Richardson
so that's the
hopefully not still there too. Yours is still there too?
No, I'm not.
So that's one of the other leadership changes. When Dr. Richardson moved up into the role of deputy director, his deputy, Kim Fridlin, who's done a very great been a great partner for Dr. Richardson and done a very good job, has stepped into the role of director of self-sufficiency. We also have a new administrator for our aging and people with disabilities division, and that's Ashley Carson Cottingham. And I've also made one other appointment. I've appointed a chief of staff, a lady by the name of Janine Beatrice, who used to work at DHS, moved over to DAS, and she and I worked in DAS together. And when I moved back, I asked her to move back with me. And really, she's been a critical person because several of the things she's done, she's really spearheaded looking at how we were going to implement Senate Bill 1515, Senator Gelser's bill. She'll be working on the implementation of Senate Bill 4080, Representative Stark's bill. And we also, one of the things we're doing is anytime I think you have leadership changes, you have the opportunity to take a step back and look at the way you're structured and look at the way you're doing business and ask ourselves, are we structured in the right way, and are our systems and processes the right systems and processes? And so we're going through an exercise of actually one by one looking at various functions within the department, and we actually are starting with the licensing function because licensing is such a critical piece when it comes to safety. And so we're doing a deep dive into our Office of Licensing and Regulatory Oversight, and Janine is the person who's heading up that analysis. And in the end, she's going to come back with some recommendations. I don't have any preconceived outcome. If it's the right structure, but we have resource or leadership issues, then that's one thing, and we'll make changes in those areas. But if they come back and say, you know, the structure really isn't working for us right now, and here's what we need to do to do, number one, make sure that we're not overburdening providers with process, and number two, to be sure that as we license people, we are licensing them in a way that ensures the safety of not just kids, but adults, seniors, people with developmental disabilities, you know, everyone that we are responsible for.
So, Clyde, didn't you make a change in licensing as well?
Yes. We currently have an interim administrator for our licensing office. We made a decision and reassigned the former head of our licensing program, and she's now working for our vocational rehabilitation division, and she's a regional manager that we station out of Bend. So the other thing we've really been looking at is the issue of provider capacity. The way I view it is really when you look at the services we provide, it's really a continuum of services or a spectrum of services, and that includes DHS, includes our paid providers, includes foster parents, and if any one part of that system is failing, it actually puts the entire system in crisis. And we, at this point in time, are starting to experience some serious issues around our provider community and our provider infrastructure. In the child welfare system around our behavioral rehabilitative service providers, we've actually, since January, lost close to 100 beds in capacity. And there's a number of different issues around that. One of them is rates. And we expect to bring the issue of rates before the 2017 session because it's something we really need to look at. And the other pieces are really around our internal process around licensing investigations and some of our payment methodologies. And so those are all things we're working with providers on. And I just feel it's critical because what's happening is as we lose capacity, it's becoming more and more difficult to find placement for our children and our adults and people with developmental disabilities. We actually are experiencing situations now where we have child welfare workers who are spending the weekend in hotels or in the office with children that we've taken into custody because we have no other place to put those children. You know, it just kind of creates this vicious cycle where that's not an appropriate place for a child, but it also puts tremendous strain on our staff, which then contributes to the turnover rate among our child welfare caseworkers, which is also a problem that we have and that we have to look into. So the other last piece, and I mentioned this last time, the other organizational change we've made is we've established something we've called the Safety Review Team. When I first came in, we had one of the reasons the governor asked me to come in is because we had several high-profile incidents with providers where it seemed like the monitoring and the accountability factor with these providers had not been attended to by the department. And so one of the questions I asked, because we have a lot of different places in the department that interact with providers and monitor providers. We have our program staff, we have our financial staff, we have licensing, we have investigations. And so one of the first questions I asked is, so what's the venue you use to get all these people who have a view into a provider together to talk about whether or not we have an issue with a provider? And the answer I got was we don't have a process to do that. So the financial people may be sitting here knowing that this provider has asked for a cash advance 3 months in a row, which is a sign that we could be having fiscal problems, and the program people would never get that piece of information. And so what we've done is we formed this team. We meet twice a month, and we staff different providers that have come to our attention to decide as a group to make sure, first of all, that everybody has a complete picture of the provider. And secondly, as a group, to decide how we're going to deal with the provider, whether they need technical assistance, whether we need to issue an intent to revoke their license, or in some cases, and we've had this happen, because of the health and safety issues, to actually go in and close a provider.
And are you talking about just child welfare or
no
provision of any of your services?
This, Chair Kennegeier, you know, for me, one of the main reasons I was asked to come in was around child welfare, but I would be remiss if we did not look at the safety of all the people we were responsible for. It's not just a child welfare issue. We should be equally as diligent about the other client groups that we're responsible for, and not just child welfare. And so, at least for now, I chair that group because I felt, number one, it would give me insight into how we were operating, and number two, I wanted to make sure that I was personally engaged in the effort. So I'll stop there, see if you have any questions, and if not, then I'll move on to an update on the child welfare assessment.
Do you have any questions?
I do.
On the overall system
assessment.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Chair
Kenny. I know you asked a lot of questions yesterday, too.
I thought I ran out of them until he mentioned.
If anyone wants to see his previous questions, watch the Senate Human Services hearing.
I wedged myself in there.
Yeah.
Interim Director Psyche. probably a conversation for down the road, but since you brought up the 100 bed loss and rates, have we looked into, and it's been a number of years since I've looked into it, so half a dozen years ago, I remember that there was a large part, I know it's very complicated, but a simplified version of some of our residential programs, mm-hmm. or groups and so forth were more of a per bed, per night sort of pay.
Right.
And have we been looking into a transition more of a per capitated or capitation type system there to allow them some financial feasibility, but also, you know, sustainability or predictability in our budget and so forth?
Yeah.
Are we going that rate at all, or have we gone that rate?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Stark, we are not there right now, but it's funny you should mention that because it's one of the options or possibilities we want to look at. Mm-hmm. One of the issues, I think, for some of our providers is that we get a per-bed rate and their population fluctuates. And so sometimes they are at capacity and they really oftentimes budget at what the capacity level is. But with that fluctuation, sometimes the amount of income or revenue they are pulling in becomes reduced. And that's what causes some that uncertainty at times causes some of the volatility. So we really have been looking internally and we are going to start discussions with various provider groups around different models, and that model is one of them. But are there other models that maybe could provide more certainty and a steadier stream of funding as opposed to kind of the volatility that's associated with a per bed payment?
Great. I would, as with all things DHS, would love to be part of that conversation, or at least keep tabs as it goes along.
Absolutely. Yeah, we would welcome your participation and help on that. It's a tough issue. It really is, and something we've struggled with for a number of years. But I'm convinced that if we don't start addressing the issue and getting our arms around it, the system is going to be in serious jeopardy.
Okay, the report.
Okay. So one of the things the governor asked me to do when I came in was to facilitate an external review of the child welfare paid provider system, child care system in the state. So we started the project in March, and we're targeting August for completion. We've contracted with Public Knowledge, who is a contractor who has a lot of experience with state agencies in the state of Oregon and in other states, and have also done these types of projects for child welfare systems in other states. We have a 17-member external advisory committee, and Vice Chair Stark is one of the members, along with Vice Chair Peluso, who I know is not here today. And the advisory committee is composed of legislators, providers, advocates, stakeholders, and two people who I think have really added a lot to the process and really actually have helped me think of things differently and look at things differently. And these two people are actually two young ladies who are former users of the foster care system. They are people who were foster youth in the past and now have aged out of the system. But the input and the kind of information they provided us, I think, has been invaluable and has actually, in some ways, changed the way I thought about things or looked at things. And so, just as an aside, this advisory committee really has been a valuable part of the process. And I was a little worried because once the project ends in August, I really wanted kind of that external view to continue, because sometimes we're so close to the issues we can't see the forest for the trees, so to speak. And we really
asked about your commission.
I was just going to get there.
There's an opportunity there.
thanks to Vice Chair Stark and House Bill 4080, We will have a child foster care advisory committee that will kind of step in and take the place of the external advisory committee. And so, you know, just my experience with the external advisory committee during this assessment process, I'm very excited about that and think it's going to be a very important tool in helping us get the child welfare system where it needs to be.
So can I ask for clarification? The more immediate external review committee is around the residential foster care.
Residential
more limited in scope to the issues that kind of blew up in the media and we were dealing with, whereas Representative Stark's commission is more the entire system, which of course include the majority of foster kids are in people's homes.
So Chair Kenny Geyer, the one thing I've said...
Residential therapeutic foster care is what I meant.
The one thing I've said from the beginning is that this first step with the external assessment is step one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are going to look at a part of the system, but it can't be the end. We have to then go forth and look at the entire system.
Right.
The issue is, if you try to look at the entire system at once, it would take years, I think, for us to get to a place where we could make the kinds of changes we needed to make. And by breaking it up into manageable pieces or increments, I think that will lead us to the kinds of changes we have to make much quicker than trying to just eat the elephant in one bite, so to speak.
Right. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the kudos on that. I do want to clarify that it's not my foster care commission.
That's what everyone calls it.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who worked on it, and you know, just my name was attached to it, so I got the credit. And ultimately, it is the governor's foster care advisory commission. And so I look forward to a bicameral, bipartisan, executive
legislative.
Okay, this is something that we all together are going to do and make sure that. That we have outside input on an ongoing basis.
That's a little take. So. Well, I wonder if you can pivot to the other report where there were 14 indicators.
Chair Kenny Geyer, we are going to get to that. I left that in Dr. Richardson's capable.
Well, there's some delegation for you.
Well, you know, there's got to be some perks that go along with being the interim director. So. And one of it is you get to cover that. So actually, really quickly, we've already completed phase one, and phase one was kind of the scoping and the methodology. We're currently in phase two. The contractor has reviewed over 100 documents and reports related to Oregon child welfare. We have a plethora of task force reports, committee reports we have possession of in legislative task force, and so they did kind of a review of that and really focused in on some of the recommendations that were made. And to be honest with you, a lot of them were never followed through on, and I think that's why we are where we are today. And they also did some process mapping around what the as-is system is, what the as-is system is today, so we kind of know where we're starting from. We have an external advisory review committee on meeting on Friday. What the contractors have got to is they've identified 15 what they're calling inquiry areas. These are areas that through the work that they've done so far, they've come up with that said, here's a problem area or a concern. And Vice Chair Stark, I'm not sure if you got it, but it was supposed to have gone out to the committee either last night or this morning, and so you should get that in time to review it for Friday meeting. And what we're actually going to ask the external advisory committee to do is prioritize those 15 areas and determine which ones we think will be the highest value in doing a deeper dive into. And so that's where we are right now. Okay.
Thank you.
And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Richardson.
Thank you. Chair Kenny Geyer, for the record, my name is Dr. Reginald Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for DHS and the Interim Child Welfare Director. I serve at great privilege for those positions under Director Psyche. There are a number of areas I could talk about in terms of our challenges and opportunities, but I'm going to really focus my comments on six major areas. What we've been focusing on, particularly as the interim, are those areas that we can get the most bang for our buck in our immediate time period. Since Director Psyche has been here at DHS, safety has been the watchword that we have been trying to discuss and talk about, think about, not only in child welfare, but the rest of DHS. And so that's really been an area of focus since I've taken on this position as well. You've already alluded to something that we sent to you earlier this month, and that is the results of our Federal Child and Family Services Review. It's not surprising to us, it wasn't, and I'm sure it wasn't surprising to the legislature, that we had some pretty significant disappointing results, that under the 14 areas, we did not do well in any of those 14 areas. And so we are still in the process of review. The first part of the review was our self-study. There's a case review, and our federal partners are on site to sort of do the quality assurance piece to make sure that the reviews are appropriate. They'll be facilitating stakeholder meetings, and so the review process is ongoing. And we hope to have a final report by September, October, but we're already beginning the process of having a program improvement plan that looks specifically at the areas that we need improvement in, specifically related to child safety, child well-being, and permanency, and then the systemic factors that sort of help to make the system the way it ought to be. There are some changes that have happened already based on that review. We're looking at how we can improve our case plans, how we can make sure that we're providing services to both the children and their parents, making sure that we are doing face-to-face visits each month, and that we're in the process of clearing up our overdue assessments. The other area that I'd like to mention is another you would have received this month a note from me saying that we decided to pause our differential response work. That decision really was made because of concerns. Are we really providing the kind of care that we needed to provide? Are we doing what we need to do? We had significant reservations about going to our largest county, Multnomah County, when we had concerns about where we were in our process. Those counties that are currently receiving or engaged in differential response will continue. I've asked the work group to continue to look at the fidelity of the model to make sure that we are delivering differential response as it's designed to be delivered. It's an opportunity for retraining of our staff, and also the other thing that we've heard consistently over the last few months is the number of activities, administrative activities, that we have asked our workers to do are really barriers to them doing what we think is most important. We know that research tells us that when workers are out in the homes of the kids and meeting with the kids and their families, that that's a much better outcome. And we have heard that the court reports and other kinds of activities that are administrative in nature has really made it very difficult for our workers to really do that kind of work that we really want them to focus on. So one of the other areas that we have looked at is to develop a work group comprised primarily of the folks who do the work and some central office staff and others to really get to an analysis of what are the kinds of activities that a worker ought to be doing versus having some lower level staff person do that kind of administrative case aid sort of work that will allow our workers to actually do the work that we've asked them to do. That work group request for volunteers went out last week, and so we're expecting to formulate that committee very soon to begin that work. The other area that I'd like to mention is that we have developed our work plan for Senate Bill 1515. so that, as you know, many of those provisions are due to become effective July 1st, and so we wanted to make sure that we're very clear about what's the expectation under that law and that we are ready to make sure that we are going to deliver the new provisions and that we have the systems in place to be able to do that. So we've got a pretty robust work plan. We've got staff in place to help us to do that, and so we are prepared to move forward. The other area that I'd like to mention just briefly and quickly is Senator Gelser and I actually attended a meeting with a client and really was surprised to learn that the Carley Law provisions are not really happening the way that they were designed. And so we are going through this past week, we sent out a transmittal to all child welfare staff, ensuring a system that they would be retrained for the provisions of that law. There's a very great video that will help in terms of our instruction and training. There's a test at the end that we suspect by, not we suspect, we will have by September 1st all DHS child welfare staff retrained or trained with the provisions of Carley's Law to make sure that we are delivering it as we have been instructed to by the legislation. And then finally, the last thing I'll just mention, the director already mentioned our work with licensing. We are doing a similar review with OWAPI, our adult investigations unit that also has responsibility to do investigations for child caring facilities. And so we want to make sure that we are looking at that structure as well. We'll begin that review once we complete the licensing review. But we've already begun to look at that in some ways already. But we'll do a much more comprehensive review once we finish the licensing review. Those are really the major areas of opportunities that we're taking a look at right now. There are many other areas, including training, that we certainly are involved in and looking at. But I wanted to emphasize what we are doing right now in sort of the immediate plan to make sure that we aren't simply an inch deep and a mile wide. We want to really try to look at the low-hanging fruit and try to make systemic change where there's the opportunity to do that right now and to continue to keep our staff on board because we have issues with turnover that we're looking at and some of these improvements we think one or will bring safety to our children that are in our care and that we are helping our staff in terms of being able to do what we've asked them to do. So I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions, and they're basically for both of you. And for Director Psyche, this is not a surprise, but here's the deal. I absolutely believe that the changes that you guys have been implementing are on the right track. And in talking with folks around at least District 20, people are watching and paying attention and recognizing that some accountability is being put in place. As we get to 2017, so 6 months forward, the questions that I'm going to be most concerned about is really, do you have the tools necessary to perhaps transition or transform some of the management personnel necessary as needed? Because I don't think it's fair to hold you accountable if you don't have the tools to fix the problem.
Right.
And the second thing is, I still have concerns about the size and scale of the agency as one agency. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the synergies are seen as a net advantage as opposed to it being too big to function, that's a concern that I want to be able to answer my constituents face up 6 months, a year down the road.
Sure.
So I guess those statements are made with the following request. If there's a tool you need that you don't have, please let lots of people know, because I do believe there's nowhere to go but up after not passing 14 out of 14,
right,
and the other issues that we have.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns I also want to emphasize is I know that sometimes when you try to fix those situations, legal costs and other things become a factor.
Mm-hmm.
In certain cases where people have, in fact, knowingly done not the public's business, those cases especially, if there are lessons learned, I want to take advantage of this opportunity while we have the chance to fix some things. Because I think at the end of the day, we get one shot to fix it.
Right.
I don't know that we get a second bite at this apple.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Representative Evans, appreciate that comment. You know, one of the challenges, I think, in talking, to, again, going back to our provider community, as we went through difficult budget times, we either froze provider rates or actually, in some cases, rolled some of them back. Okay. And to be honest with you, we've never caught up from that to this point in time. So that is one serious issue that we are going to raise in 17 and want to have a serious discussion with Chair Kenny Geyer, your committee, and Senator Gelser's committee, and Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson's Ways and Means Committee. You know, and the other thing I think is when you look at the issues around the proficiency and competency of caseworkers, especially in the child welfare area, we have not done a very good job in training and providing caseworkers with the tools they need to do the job. I would submit to you that our child welfare caseworkers have one of the most difficult jobs.
Absolutely.
In not just in state government, but in the state, and the consequences of bad decisions are catastrophic. You know, one of the things I asked when I came in, I said, so, okay, I know we do some intensive upfront training with our caseworkers. We bring them in, send them through the Portland State program, and then we send them out in the field. And so my question was, after they've been out in the field for a while, what do we do to bring them back and do refreshers, but also talk about what their experience has been? Because no matter how much you train a person in the classroom, it in no way prepares them for what they see once they get out into the field. And we need to be bringing our caseworkers back after a year, 2 years, 3 years, to constantly update, refresh, and if nothing else, talk to them about where we're missing the mark and what we need to boost up as far as the tools they need to do their job and the training that they're getting. And I will tell you that right now, our turnover rate for child welfare caseworkers in the first, second, and third year is concerning. And we have to do something to turn that around. Because the one thing I will tell you is that one of the most important factors in working with the kids and families who come into our care is stability. And having a child or a family have two or three different caseworkers over the course of a short period of time is not helping and actually is detrimental to that family and to that child.
Well, I just want to echo a lot of what Representative Evans said in terms of making sure that you clarify for us what the tools are you need, whether it's management tools or whatever. I'm a very, very, very strong proponent of increasing the resources needed for this for the system. On one hand, we can't throw money at it and think right. that's going to solve it, and so there's a lot of work on your end in terms of changing the culture, holding people accountable, rolling heads when needed, and really making some dramatic changes. And so it's not just about money, but it also cannot be done without money. It's been a constant limiting factor, as we heard, in terms of internal capacity in housing and community services. And I know you were sitting here for that. Mm-hmm. That a thousandfold for you all. Mm-hmm. And I will do everything I can to fight to increase resources that are so badly needed, because this has been an ongoing structural deficit forever. And then from your end, we really need strong leadership, which so far I have certainly seen to date. But, you know, for all of us who are sitting here under a number of different leaders, it does seem like we're in this chronic crisis, you know, time after time. I mean, to come back and have 14, this was not under you, but still to miss 14 out of 14 milestones here is really depressing. And we're alarmed every single time. And so I think we have a good start now with your leadership. I am very concerned about the stress on the two of you and the fact that you're doing two jobs right now. And I'm really hoping that you find somebody mm-hmm. very soon. And yes, I mean, if we had more money, maybe we could make that happen even sooner. But, you know, we'll continue to be alarmed and have this eat up a lot of every single time we have a hearing. this is it. I do have, you know, in the back of my head, I'm very concerned about memory care, long-term care.
Absolutely.
And some of the very similar issues that are facing children are facing that other very vulnerable population, and that hasn't been on the front of all the papers, but we did hear the example in Coos Bay, and while our task force did not pass, Representative McEwen and I and anyone else interested are going to go forward with the task force, and I've been talking with people about that recently, and with your own department and with your new director Ashley. So we will proceed on that with the same kind of level of concern that we have about this.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, I actually had a chance to talk to Representative McEwen last week in Florence. We were there for a tribal meeting, and I am also very concerned. And what I requested from her is that I definitely want Ashley to be on that task force that you're forming, but I would also like to be a participant.
That's fantastic.
On that group.
Fantastic. That's great. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Just want to tell you guys, appreciate what you're doing. I think that the department overall in many areas, not just the 14 listed, I think we have a long and difficult road to recovery. And so I appreciate you guys leading the charge on that and for taking that courageous positions. My prediction is that Dr. Richardson will be whiter than me in about a year.
But this is what's happened to you working on this issue.
So quickly, appreciate your work. Keep it up.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Close the hearing on DHS updates and child welfare and opening an informational hearing on child poverty presentation by Children First of Oregon. Thank you for all of you hanging in there with us.
Barta.
Make full use of our three-hour hearings.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, we're really happy to be here. And
your name for the record, please.
And my name for the record is James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon. And we're working with more than 80 organizations as United for Kids so we can make Oregon a better place to be a kid. Now, I just want to say I know we're at the end of a long hearing, and I wish we had a light topic for you, but it is a topic of children in poverty, and I'm hoping that some of the data and some of the ideas that my colleague will present is something that you'll be able to use with other legislators, with other advocates, and with your constituents, because it's a different way of thinking about it and some different presentations that you may have seen than from what you've seen before. So with that, I get the easy part in just introducing my colleague, Jason Gettle.
Thank you, James, and Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Gettle. I'm the research director at Children First for Oregon. And as James mentioned, today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about child poverty. And we're hoping that as you prepare for the upcoming legislative session, you'll be mindful of just how many kids in Oregon are living in poverty and how the policies you enact will impact them. And I'll try to go through some of these things rather quickly because it is the end of the day. At the end of the day, and the lights are going down, so hopefully it won't be.
Sun's going down.
Coffee's in.
Hopefully, it won't be too sleepy. But to start with, we start with perhaps the most boring slide, and then the last slide is also pretty boring. But to begin, in talking about child poverty data, the place to begin is the U.S. Census Bureau. It's the official source when it comes to measuring poverty, and in particular, the American Community Survey is the go-to resource for measuring poverty at the state level. The most recent data we have available from the ACS is for 2014. The 2015 data will be available in the fall, likely sometime around mid-September. The way the Census Bureau determines poverty is it compares household income to what's called the federal poverty thresholds. These are slightly different than the federal poverty guidelines, which are used to determine eligibility for some public assistance programs, but they operate in basically the same way. It's an income limit that is set based on household size and composition. If the household income is above that limit, you're not in poverty. If it's below that limit, you are in poverty, according to the Census Bureau. We'll look a little bit more closely at what exactly that means in just a minute.
I'll just tell you, you have 20 pages in less than 20 minutes.
Okay.
So you might want to skip over some of the, you know, really the science that you're explaining to us.
Okay. I will be sure to wrap up, hopefully, by 5. So by this definition, the overall poverty rate in Oregon was 16.6% in 2014. And to put that in context, the national rate was 15.5%. So Oregon was slightly above the national rate. However, just looking at this rate, this piece of a pie, it might not seem like that big, that the problem is that big. However, we know that there were almost 4 million people living in Oregon in 2014. So what does 16.6% actually mean? It means that there are a lot of people living in poverty. In fact, there were more Oregonians living in poverty in 2014 than there were living in the city of Portland. There were about 602,000 people living in the city of Portland that year, and about 644,000 living in poverty. So if poverty were a city in Oregon, it would be our state's largest city. That's a lot of people. And unfortunately, the rate of poverty among children is higher. While the overall poverty rate was 16.6%, the rate of poverty among children in our state in 2014 was 21.6%, 5 percentage points higher. In recent years, this trend is pretty typical. Here, the green bars represent the child poverty rate, where the gray line is the overall poverty rate. As you can see, the child poverty rate tends to be a few percentage points higher than the overall rate. Also, as you can see, the 21.6% in 2014 is down from a peak in 2011, but it still remains above where it was during the most recent recession. Having an elevated poverty rate in 2014 is problematic. It's 5 years after the end of the recession. And as many have noted, in all likelihood, we're closer to the next recession than we are to the previous one. And if our poverty rate remains at this level, we'll be in a worse position, and over a fifth of our children will be in a worse position to weather the next recession. And the child poverty doesn't affect all Oregonians equally. One way that child poverty varies is by geography.
Sorry, question.
Yes, I see your Thank county you. Down there. It's a little concerning.
So, on the last slide, does this mirror overall, even though it's higher than the general population poverty, is that trend mirroring with the general population?
They tend to move together. Yes, the. on a percentage basis. So when the overall rate is lower in terms of the child poverty rate is closer in terms of percentage points, but it's roughly the same like ratio below.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, child poverty rates tend to vary by count or by geography also. As you can see here, these are child poverty rates by county, and the darker shades of green represent higher rates of child poverty. Some of the more rural eastern areas of our state have some of the highest rates of child poverty. In some of those counties, more than a third of children were living in poverty during this time period. This is another look at the same data, but presented differently. Here, the length of the bars represents the child poverty rate, while the shade of green represents the total child population in the county. And again, as you can see, there's a cluster of lighter green at the top, meaning those more rural counties have higher child poverty rates, where so the more populous counties are kind of scattered throughout. So for example, Marion County is in the roughly top quarter. Multnomah County is kind of in the middle. Washington and Clackamas County have some of the lower rates of child poverty in the state. Another way that...
Gilliam County is really an outlier.
It's an outlier in terms of population, too. Yes. The Another way that child poverty rates vary is by race and ethnicity. Unfortunately, children of color in our state are more likely to be poor than white children. In 2014, about 17% of non-Hispanic white children were in poverty, and about 30% of children of color were in poverty. And there's also some variation within that group, with some groups facing very high child poverty rates. For example, the child poverty rate was 33% for Hispanic children, while it was about 44% for American Indian or Alaskan Native children, about 46% for Black children, and 54% for Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander children. Now, while the rates do vary across the state and among different groups in our state, I wanted to take a step back and revisit that top line number for a minute. And remember, that was 21.6% of children in our state were living in poverty. That means that more than one out of five kids was living in poverty in 2014 in Oregon. Again, that might not seem like a lot. There were four out of five who weren't living in poverty. But let's, again, put that in context. In 2014, there were about 860,000 kids in Oregon. If 21.6% were living in poverty, about how many kids were poor? Don't worry, this isn't a math test. It's just it's a way to put this in perspective and see how big of a problem child poverty is. In 2014, there were more than enough kids living in poverty to fill seven of Oregon's most popular arenas and stadiums. That includes Autzen Stadium, Research Stadium, Providence Park, the Moda Center, Matthew Knight Arena, Hayward Field, and the Gill Coliseum. That's a lot of kids, over 180,000 kids. And remember, as I mentioned at the beginning, these are based on the official federal poverty thresholds. These thresholds don't take into account actual expenses. They don't vary by geography across the country. And they were derived in the 1960s based on the cost of food and the rough proportion of income that people tended to spend on food. As we know, a lot has changed since the 1960s. And while these thresholds have been adjusted for inflation since then, they haven't kept up with the pressures that families face. Let's take a look at what it actually means to be poor and not poor, according to the Census Bureau. For example, a family of three, if we can look here at the average weighted poverty thresholds by family size, a family of three would have to earn less than about $19,000 in 2014 to be considered poor. A single parent raising two kids, earning $9.25 an hour, working full-time year-round, would earn about $19,240. This family would not be considered to be in poverty according to those thresholds. And thus, they wouldn't be included in any of the statistics that I've mentioned thus far. At the same time, it's really hard to imagine that this family, a single parent raising two kids, on $9.25 an hour, would not have a difficult time to make ends meet. To get a bit better picture of how many families and how many kids are actually really struggling, we also look at the number of kids living at or near poverty. And one way to do so is to look at 200% of the federal poverty level. And by this measure, that same three-person family would have to earn less than $37,700 to be considered living in or near poverty. Doing this more than doubles the number of children and families that are struggling. In total, there are about 390,000 kids in Oregon living in or near poverty in 2014. That's enough to fill those same seven stadiums, plus the two largest stadiums on the West Coast, the Rose Bowl and the LA Memorial Coliseum, and still have about 30,000 kids standing outside. Again, that's a lot of kids. It's almost 5 o'clock, and I have just one more point that I wanted to make. And this is about how we measure poverty and to let you know that some progress is being made, both in real terms and in measurement terms. I'd just like to take a quick moment to talk about something called the Supplemental Poverty Measure that the Census Bureau is working on. This measure takes a closer look at both the income and the expense side of the equation. It takes into account taxes paid, expenses from the community expenditure survey, and it does vary by geography across the country. It also includes tax credits, like the earned income tax credit, as well as other non-cash benefits, such as SNAP or food stamp benefits. For example, under the official poverty measure, SNAP benefits are not counted, while Social Security income is counted. Similarly, child support received is included in income, but child support paid is not excluded from household income. The supplemental poverty measure is designed to address these issues. And taking all of this into account tends to reduce the child poverty level. Unfortunately, it also tends to increase it for adults and seniors, but as far as kids are concerned, it does tend to show that these programs make a difference. So for example, in 2014, nationally, the U.S. official child poverty rate was 21.5%, while using the supplemental measure, the child poverty rate was 16.7%. So a pretty sizable difference. Unfortunately, due to the lack of federal funding, this supplemental poverty measure is stuck in research mode. The Census Bureau is continuing to work with the Bureau of Labor Statistics to move it into production mode. Until it gets there, we don't have the kind of detail like we have with the American Community Survey. So for now, at least, we continue to work with what we have. But I bring up the supplemental poverty measure for two reasons. The first is to let you know that it's widely acknowledged that the official poverty measure leaves a lot to be desired, but at the same time, there is progress being made on an alternative. The second reason I bring it up is to let you know that the safety net does work. Using a measure that better captures the safety net shows that these programs do have an impact, especially among reducing poverty among children, even though it might not show up in the official poverty data. In fact, researchers using the supplemental poverty measure and adjusting for underrepresented income at the Washington, D.C.-based Center on Budget and Policy Priorities show that nationally, the safety net programs tend to cut the overall poverty rate roughly in half. And the impact is more pronounced here in Oregon. Here, the rate was cut by about two-thirds. In other words, the safety net and the work that legislators, the work that you all do, does have an impact on these families. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate you having us here, and I appreciate your interest in this issue. It is important to keep Oregon's kids in mind and as you prepare for the upcoming legislative session, and particularly keep in mind that there are a lot of kids living in poverty, and the work that you do does have an impact. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. You've ended at exactly 5. Good job. Thank you for putting your report online. So if anyone wants to refer back to it, that's great.
Yep.
And thank you for your work. It's an important organization. Keeping a focus on kids.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. With that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on child poverty and close our hearing on the House Human Services and Housing Committee. And thank our Housing Committee.